check this out, man.
For a minute that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. Who, you know, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only answer.
Gonna rise up, take what's there. It's finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This week in radical history for the week starting August 4th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
As reported in the San Francisco Herald on this date, August 4th, 1869, San Francisco land speculator Emperor Norton I declares the United States dissolve, and the greatest and wise ruler of the United States abolishes both Democratic and Republican parties. He's quoted in the paper as saying, "Party strife now exists within the realm. I do hereby dissolve and abolish Democratic and Republican parties, and also do hereby decree the disfranchisement and imprisonment for not more than 10 years and no less than 5 years to all persons leading to any violation of this your imperial decree." So remember, when you go out and vote Democrat or Republican this coming year, you're going to be in violation of the emperor's decree. Wouldn't want to do that now. In other empire news, in 1925 on this date, U.S. Marines leave Nicaragua after 13 years of occupation. Don't worry, they'll be back again and again. Also on August 4, 1944, Netherlands, Nazi police in Amsterdam, acting on an informant's tip, discover Anne Frank and the family in hiding. The eight lived in a single secret room for 728 days, then were sent to the notorious Belsen concentration camp where they were killed except the father. He returned to the house after the war and found Anne's diary. Began at age 12, he recorded the feelings and thoughts, pressures and fears, while coming to age during 2 years of hiding from death. Translated in over 30 languages, is a symbol of strength and how brutal humans can be to other humans. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Jackie Cook. On this day, August 4th, in 1964, the bodies of American civil rights activists James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman were found in the Mississippi River after disappearing 2 months earlier. The three young activists had traveled together to Mississippi to register black voters and investigate the bombing of a black church. After being arrested for supposed speeding, they were released onto a dark, remote road and greeted by carloads of Ku Klux Klan members. The Klansmen shot the two Jewish New Yorkers, Schwerner and Goodman. But Chaney, a black Mississippi native, was brutally beaten with chains and mutilated before being shot. The killings received massive media attention and ignited public sympathy. But civil rights activists criticized the publicity, stating that had two of the victims not been white, the case would have been largely ignored. Can you think of any other cases like this? Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Lastly, on August 4th, 1988, Congress votes 20,000 each Japanese Americans in turn during World War II. This week in radical history for August 5th, 1498. What? No kangaroos? Columbus is the first recent European to land in South America continent, and he thinks he landed in Australia. Speaking of colonization in the New World in this date in 1620, the Mayflower and Speedwell sail away and also do not find Australia. Unfortunately for Native American, they find them instead. Also on August 5th, 1892, Harry Tubman gets a pension from Congress for her work as a nurse, spy, and scout during the Civil War. She, along with Sojourn Truth and Susie King and almost 200 other African-American women, served as nurses during the war in 11 hospitals in over three states. Also on August 5, 1936, James Colton, who married anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman in 1925 to provide her with British citizenship, dies of cancer. Colton, an elderly anarchist from Wales, married Emma so she'd be free from the problems of traveling and giving lectures. Also on this date, 1964, U.S. begins bombing of North Vietnam to protect American interests, of course.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on August 5th, 1990, Bush sends U.S. Marines into Liberia to protect American interests.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality.
This week in Radical History for August 6th, 1855, Bloody Monday riots. A Louisville, Kentucky mob pulling a brass cannon attacks Irish Quarter, burning down houses and killing at least 20, the Irish being the Mexicans of our day. Also on August 6th, 1890, on Good Friday, of course, the first electric chair execution in the United States happens in Auburn Prison in New York. It was a gruesome execution. It had to be done over and over again. And no, he did not rise in 3 days. Also on August 6th, 1927, Massachusetts High Court hears final plea for those anarchist bastards, Sutko and Vizzetti. Protest bombs hit homes of Baltimore mayor and Boston mayor. Their controversial trial attracted numerous international attention, with critics accusing the prosecution and presiding judge of improper conduct, like calling them those anarchist bastards, and allowing of anti-Italian, anti-immigrant, and anti-anarchist sentiment to prejudice the jury. Prominent Americans such as Upton Sinclair publicly sided with the citizen-led opposition to the verdict. The two executed elicited mass protests in New York, London, Amsterdam, Tokyo. Workers walked out across South America, and riots in Paris, Geneva, and Germany, as well as Johannesburg, occurred. Also on August 6, 1945, U.S. drops atomic bomb on a civilian population of Hiroshima, the U.S. being the only country to use this massive type of WMD. Destroying homes of almost 400,000 people, the bomb explodes in the air and destroys more than two-thirds of the city's buildings. About half the population is burned in ruins, burned to death by the explosive heat or consumed by fire. Thousands of survivors develop radiation sickness, and in 1 month, hundreds more would die in makeshift hospitals and other weakened buildings crumble around them. There is no practical reason to drop the bomb. It did nothing to shorten the war, and Japan was already trying to negotiate peace with the United States. The United States is simply determined to show Russia who is calling a tune in the post-World War. Also on August 6, 1957, 11 activists from the Committee of Nonviolence Action arrested at Atomic Test Proving Grounds in Nevada, the first of what eventually become thousands arrested in Nevada test site and hundreds of thousands around the world. Also on that date, 1967, Indian Claims Commission awards $12.2 million to 8 Lakota tribes for 29 million acres, most of them in the Upper Great Plains, taken by fraudulent treaties. Also on that date, 1985, USSR begins unilateral moratorium on nuclear testing. U.S. responds by conducting more underground nuclear tests. Then in 1989, U.S. expressed moral outrage at India and Pakistan for similar testing. Also on August 6, 1988, Tompkins Square Park police riot in New York. A videotape of the police riot got five cops indicted, the chief retired, the captain moved out of the ninth precinct, and more cops were disciplined and some fired. Lastly, on this date, in 1990, UN Security Council imposed economic sanctions in Iraq. Total deaths of children under age five from the cause of sanctions from 1990 to November 1999 was 502,495 deaths of children. This week in Radical History for August 7th, 1854. Rumor that all Catholic churches were arsenals brings a mob of axe-wielding Protestants to St. Louis House of Worship. Eight Irish were butchered like cattle and 30 more seriously wounded, the Irish being the Mexicans of our day. Also on August 7th, 1960, Fidel Castro announces plans to nationalize all American holdings. U.S. and the Mafia, which controlled the economy, fights back. And U.S. government takes the moral high ground and begins a nonstop campaign to assassinate Fidel Castro. Also on this date, 1967, Gulf of Tonkin resolution in response to a falsely report of attacks the U.S. destroyer passes the House 416-0 and the Senate 88-2, giving LGB extraordinary powers authorizing him to use all necessary steps to win the war in Vietnam. Only two legislatures, Morris and Running, vote against it, with no opposition in the House. Then the FBI begins collecting the names of supporters of Morris, and his office phone lines are tapped. Same war, different year. Also on that date, 1978, the Love Canal subdivision, Niagara Falls, New York, built on a site of former Harker Chemical Company chemical dump, formally declared a toxic disaster area by President Carter. Also on this date, 1979, highly enriched uranium released from a top-secret nuclear fuel plant near Irwin, Tennessee. About 1,000 people are contaminated with up to five times as much radiation they would normally receive in any given year. Lastly, for August 7, 1995, due to international pressure, State of Pennsylvania announces the stay of its planned August 17th execution of political prisoner Mumia Ajamil. U.S. officials have vowed to silence Mumia at all costs and take extraordinary actions to do so. NPR buckles under the pressure from the right wing. Temple University in Philadelphia, owners of seven Pennsylvania radio stations, also buckles under pressure, refused to air tapes in defense of him, cancels contract with Pacifica Network. Free press? Yeah. This week in radical history for August 8th, 1449. Portuguese slaver Henry the Navigator unloads six ship of human cargo slaves from Africa. He proclaims it is the, quote, salvation, unquote, of their souls. Also on August 8th, 1879, Mexico, revolutionary hero, anarchist Emilio Zapata lives. He'll inspire the Zapatista movement. Zapata will continue to live as long as the people believe that they have the right to their own lands and the right to govern themselves according to their own deeply held beliefs and cultural values. Also on August 8, 1925, a huge KKK rally held in Washington, D.C. The modern-day KKK, known as skinheads, with all the right-wing anti-immigrant sentiment, skinheads are increasing in numbers around the United States and the world. Also on this date, 1942, India National Congress passes Quit India Resolution, leading to mass arrests by their British masters. Two more items for August 8, 1974. Tricky Dick Nixon, no longer claiming he is a crook, announces he'll resign. Said, I am not a quitter. Then he quits. Also claimed during the Vietnam War to be a pacifist. Guess he got that one wrong, too. Also on that date, 1980, Reagan aide William Casey leaves on his second trip to bribe Iranians to delay the release of U.S. hostage until Reagan takes office. Only got a couple items this week in radical history for August 9th, 1779. General Clinton and 1,500 American troops break dam and flood the Iroquois towns and fields in upstate New York. Troops then burn and ravage settlement for 12 days. Also on that date, 1945, America Fat Boy dropped on Nagasaki. About 70,000 more civilians die immediately. Truman drops the bomb to prove to Russia that he's tough and gets the Cold War arms race off to an unhealthy start. Also on August 6, 1966, 200 sit-in in New York City's offices of Dow Chemical Company to protest the use of napalm in Vietnam. Edward Abbey would say, a patriot must always be ready to defend his country against his government. Lastly, for August 9, 1997, New York City cops rape and torture Abner Louima, a legal immigrant from Haiti, sodomize him with a plunger. New York cops always practice their own unique form of justice. This week in radical history for August 10th, only got a couple items. 1877, U.S. Army troops under Colonel Gibson attack a sleeping Nez Perce encampment at Big Hole, Idaho, killing over 50 women and children. Also on August 10th, 1893, Chinese are deported from San Francisco under the first Chinese Exclusion Act to exclude Chinese workers from the United States. The Chinese being Irish of that day, the Chinese and Irish being the Mexicans of our day. 1968, eight American GIs killed by U.S. strafing error in Vietnam. Quote, Vietnam was the first war ever fought without censorship of the media. Without censorship, things can go terribly confusing in the public mind, unquote. General William Westmoreland, U.S. military commander. Lastly, on the state in 1981, the closing of the Nixon Museum, says manager Pete Mitchell, quote, if nothing else, it's been a good stopping point for people to use the restrooms between Los Angeles and San Diego. This has been This Week in Radical History. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, thanks to some audio borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and more radical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Thanks for listening to this week's This Week in Radical History, produced at the Glee Glee Studios. And as always, until next week, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
A voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, God, I voted.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. Again this morning, we continue our coverage of the Balfour Legacy Conference, held in Cambridge, Massachusetts on November 11th of 2017. Today featuring an extraordinary panel on intersectionality, the relationship of all human rights struggles with each other, and the power of that recognition. The first to speak on the panel is Matoi Monroe, a co-leader of the American Indians of New England. She's also lead organizer for the Indigenous Peoples Day, which works to get communities to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day in lieu of Columbus Day, as was done by Cambridge in 2016. Matoi is followed by Gabriel Camacho, whose parents emigrated from Mexico in the 1990s. Gabe has served on the boards of a myriad of Latino organizations and currently is the Immigration Program Coordinator for the American Friends Service Committee. The next panelist to speak is Carl Williams, currently a staff attorney with the ACLU of Massachusetts and former defense attorney for the Roxbury Defenders. He is active with the National Lawyers Guild and is a lecturer at the Northeastern Law School. The final speaker is Nadia Ben-Youssef, a lawyer and human rights activist and the first U.S. representative for ADLA, the legal center for Arab minority rights located in Haifa, Israel. She is now developing ADLA's U.S. advocacy strategy to shape American discourse and influence U.S. policy and practice in Palestine, Israel. Here is the intersectionality panel of the Balfour Legacy Conference.
My name is Matoi, and I'm co-leader of United American Indians of New England, and I'm also a lead organizer for Indigenous Peoples Day campaigns here in the state, including in Cambridge, where we won Indigenous Peoples Day in June of 2016. I always say to people that one of the reasons that we do Indigenous Peoples Day is because non-Native people don't listen to us and act as though that we're not here. And we are literally trying to save the earth. And if you can't listen to us, we're not going to be able to do that. So Indigenous Peoples Day is an important first step in bringing Native voices more to the center where they should be. I want to acknowledge before I begin today that we are on stolen Indigenous land, the land of the Massachusetts people. This land was never ceded. There is no treaty. They were simply pushed off the land. The river was given an English name. The city was given an English name. When I think about al-Nakba and Palestine, it was preceded not only by the Balfour Declaration, but also the British Mandate, Napoleon, the Crusades, the Catholic Church's doctrine of discovery, and many other doctrines. All of these combined represent an entire settler worldview with roots not only in theology, but going further back to the very origins of private property and patriarchy and the rise of the state. First, they justified it with theology, and later, they justified it as the white man's burden. And now, as the U.S. does, in the name of supposedly protecting human rights. Under various theological and legal doctrines formulated during and after the Crusades, non-Christians were considered enemies of the Catholic faith and as such less than human. The Dum Diversus Bull of 1452 and other related bulls, those are like edicts issued by popes, granted the pope's blessing to capture, vanquish, and subdue the Saracens, pagans, and other enemies of Christ and put them into perpetual slavery and to take all their possessions and their property. The Inter Cetera Bull of 1493 granted authority to Spain and Portugal to take all lands and possessions so long as no other Christian ruler had previously claimed them. These bulls instilled the doctrine of discovery, the papal sanctioning of Christian enslavement and power over non-Christians. Indigenous peoples in the Americas have our own Nakba. That was the invasions of Columbus, Cortez, Cabot, and all the others. When Columbus sailed west across the so-called Sea of Darkness, with the express understanding that he was authorized to take possession of any lands he discovered that were not under the dominion of any Christian rulers, he and the Spanish sovereigns of Aragon and Castile were following an already well-established tradition of discovery and conquest that was very much focused on Palestine. Acts of genocide and conquest committed by Columbus and his men and all the other invaders against the peaceful native people of the Caribbean were sanctioned. The papal documents were frequently used by invaders in the Americas to justify an incredibly brutal system of colonization, which referred to the territories as being inhabited only by brute animals. With all of this history behind them, of course the British and League of Nations felt free to carve up and distribute Palestine. Zionists spoke about Palestine as a land without people for a people without a land. And even if the land was inconveniently not entirely empty, it was somehow full of people who had no real connections to the place. They didn't know how to develop and exploit the land the way the Europeans did, the Zionists said. They didn't know how to make the desert bloom, and so they lacked legitimacy on the land. The indigenous people everywhere lose legitimacy because we are somehow not sufficiently there, yet too much there. And then we lose legitimacy because we are made up of nomads who don't really care about the place the way the settled Europeans do. And so Palestinians were pushed onto reservations, really. Refugee camps, Gaza, these are all reservations. Now here, the pilgrims in Plymouth and the Puritans here in Boston and Cambridge, here in this very parish, actually, we always bring history home to where we are. They were obsessed with the idea that they were in a wilderness, as though the land were empty and waiting for them. This idea is so embedded that even today, I hear from school children and adults alike that the Europeans brought civilization here, that indigenous peoples were not actually doing anything with the land. I speak about this to make clear that the U.S. and Israel are both settler nations. Sometimes I have noticed that people here can point to Israel as a settler state, but cannot see that is the case right here. If you claim to support the struggle of Palestinians, then you must also be supporting indigenous struggles right here. Sometimes settlers talk about working toward reconciliation, and that's been the case in Canada. But reconciliation still means you're taking our land and putting pipelines through it and destroying our water, doesn't it? So reconciliation is nice, and apologies are nice, but that is not nearly enough. What we need is decolonization. When we are talking about decolonization, let's review who is here. Here in the United States, we have indigenous peoples here, many of them now coming from Mexico, El Salvador, and other settler countries, but they're indigenous. We didn't have those borders. We have settlers. They and their progeny stole land and eradicated millions of native peoples in every single inch of stolen state of the United States. Settlers became their own law. They became their own government. They supplanted indigenous laws and beliefs with their own values. We also have millions of stolen peoples, black people whose ancestors were largely brought here as slaves. I've heard sometimes people say that if you're not indigenous, you're a settler. That's not true. Stolen peoples can't at all be called settlers. We also have newcomers who came here after the dirty work of the slaughter and displacement of indigenous peoples, but who often adopt the worldview of settlers. These newcomers benefit from settler colonialism, whether or not they intend to, by dint of living on stolen indigenous land. Every aspect of what we do and think needs to be decolonized, treating the earth and life like a commodity, consuming resources endlessly. This is also at the foundation of settler colonialism. I read a good definition of decolonization. It is the intelligent, calculated, and active resistance to the forces of colonialism that perpetuates the subjugation and or exploitation of our minds, bodies, and lands. Decolonization is engaged for the ultimate purpose of overturning the colonial structure and realizing indigenous liberation. Well, I would actually say that decolonization is for the liberation of all of us, because all of us are poisoned by settler colonialism. Every aspect of our lives and thought have been impacted. Ultimately, decolonization should lead to the return of control of the land to indigenous peoples. This does not necessarily mean that everybody needs to leave, but it does mean that indigenous people have the right to decide what happens, and that should put a stop to things like pipelines and fracking pretty fast. I know this idea of decolonization and return of lands and control of indigenous peoples is uncomfortable for settlers to admit to and to talk about, but this fear of who has a right to claim and control the land is very much the basis of settler hatred for indigenous peoples. Finally, as an indigenous human being, I have the utmost feelings of solidarity with the Palestinian people because they are our relatives. Palestinian people must have the right to decide what the fate of their country should be. Their right to self-determination must be respected first and foremost. I believe that all of us must support and learn from Palestinians on their own terms and support their resistance without providing a settler colonial overlay of what we think are acceptable forms of resistance. Thank you.
What we're going to do is thank you for the framing. That was excellent. And what I'm going to do is focus on a comparison between territorial loss in Mexico and what's going on in Palestine now. So, and the reason why I've been going around doing this presentation is because organizations, Zionist organizations, such as the ADL, the JCRC, are actually inviting leaders of the immigrant community, of the Latino immigrant community, in all expenses, paid trips to Israel to show them how good they treat their immigrants, meaning Jews from Europe and North America. So, so without further ado, we're going to go on. I was asked to abbreviate this presentation. But basically, I mean, we all know that, you know, Palestine and Mexico are continents apart, different historical and cultural development. However, let's do a very brief comparison. So in Mexico, the Spaniards invaded the New World in the early 1500s, followed by other European empires. In Palestine, after various Eurasian empires ruled the Middle East, Palestine is ruled by the Ottoman Empire. In Mexico, Mexico becomes a possession of the Spanish crown. Palestine becomes a mandate of the British Empire after World War I. In Mexico, in 1821, Mexico gains independence from Spain and outlaws slavery. It's one of the first laws it passes as an independent country. In the 1830s, U.S. Slave state expansionists begin to settle in the Mexican state of Texas, or what you call Texas, and campaigns of ethnic cleansing ensue. In the late 1800s, the European Zionist movement plans to colonize Palestine. Zionist violence terrorized Christian and Muslim Palestinians in the early 1900s, and campaigns of ethnic cleansing ensue. This is the basic pattern of settler colonialism. In Mexico, the lone state of Texas declares itself independent from Mexico and is later annexed by the United States. Provoked by U.S. settler aggression, Mexico declares war on the U.S. in 1846. U.S. invades Mexico, and this is very interesting. Irish nationals in the U.S. infantry defect to the Mexican army. Oh, good. So have you heard of this story, the San Patricios? Oh, yeah. Very interesting. Irish Americans won't talk about this, but in Ireland they will talk about it. In Palestine, in 1947, the U.N. partition plan is approved with the support of Western powers, but rejected by Arab nations, as we heard before in the various panels. Under the UN partition plan, 55% of historic Palestine is apportioned to, quote, a Jewish state, and Arab states reject the plan. The Treaty of Guadalupe and Hidalgo and al-Nakba. Treaty of Guadalupe and Hidalgo is what we consider our Nakba. In 1848, interesting, 100 years before, 1848, Mexico loses 50% of its national territory to the United States. The newly acquired territories include the states of Texas, Colorado, Nevada, Arizona, Nuevo Mexico, California, Utah, and Wyoming. Nakba, 1948, Palestine loses, as you know, 48% of its land to the Jewish state. Over 750,000 Palestinians are dispossessed from their homes and their lands. Thousands become refugees in their own land or flee to other neighboring countries. And this is very interesting because AFSC does have a lot of history in this area. AFSC is asked by the UN to provide humanitarian relief in the Gaza Strip shortly after the Nakba. Well, this is what Mexico used to look like. In the entire southwest and west. That's what Palestine used to look like. And this here is, and this is the partition plan. As we heard before, we don't need to explain it here. And then afterwards, Texas is annexed to the newly acquired United States. So basically, what's east of the Mississippi starts becoming part of the United States. This is after the war, and basically what's left for Palestinians is the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And then this is Mexico today, as you know. There's a lot of violence along the border, in particular because of the walls and all the security apparatus that the United States is investing, including the State of Israel, as we heard before. So we also looked at manifest destiny in Zionism, because you need an ideology to justify the taking over a territory and also to dehumanize the other person. So manifest destiny is expansionist. Zionism is expansionist. Manifest destiny has the racist notion of civilizing the West. Remember, it was Native Americans and Mexicans that lived in that area, therefore savages. So Zionism is the racist notion of a land without a people for a people without a land, although early Zionists acknowledged that there were many Palestinians living in those lands. Manifest Destiny presumes racial superiority of white people over indigenous and Mexican people. Zionism presumes racial superiority of Jews over Palestinians and other Arabs. And this, therefore, justifies ethnic cleansing in both historical examples. Two walls. So, basically, in the United States, in 2006, the U.S. Congress passed the Secure Fence Act, which would expand the wall between Mexico and the United States by 700 miles. And just a footnote, I made this presentation back in 2008. Colesman Inc. of New Hampshire, a wholly owned subsidiary of Elbit Systems of Haifa, Israel, builds the high-tech portions of that wall, meaning the motion sensors, the infrared cameras, and all that stuff. Billions of dollars. In the West Bank, in 2005, the Israeli Knesset approves the plan to build an apartheid wall well within the West Bank. Elbit Systems, the largest private military contractor in Israel, builds the apartheid wall inside the West Bank. So here we have a direct connection between what's going on in the U.S.-Mexico border and what's going on in the West Bank. This is a rather old map before the wall was complete. I won't go over it now because of time. But basically, I organized a delegation of color to go to Palestine in 2008. And we had Asian Americans, Latin Americans, Native Americans, African Americans go to Palestine and to view Palestine from our particular perspective of racial discrimination in the United States, our history of national liberation throughout the world, and indeed our fight for civil rights and autonomy here in the United States. So what we learned with talking to our Palestinian brothers and sisters was that the apartheid idea of cantons and Bantustans are being applied to the West Bank, ever-shrinking areas where Palestinians can live and work. We discuss Israeli political, economic, and military relations with apartheid South Africa and the right-wing military dictatorships of Central America during the 1980s. We discuss the impunity police have in killing people of color, incarceration rates, and military-style ICE rates. This was before Ferguson. We learned the idea of transfer, the forceful removal of Palestinians from their land to other Arab nations is a common political discourse amongst Israeli Jews. And we also talk about gentrification. We learned about the idea of security and terrorism justifies checkpoints, arbitrary arrests, detentions, and border militarization. So basically, we learned that together we have one struggle. I think I'm out of time. So this is just a picture. You know, can you tell that's Palestine? Can you tell that's Mexico? Not really. The fence, same company builds it. One interesting thing, we saw the image of Che Guevara all over the refugee camps. And, you know, that made me feel very warm and comfortable. So, so again, you know, this is basically a presentation to start a conversation on how we can build an intersectional movement between Latin Americans here in the United States and in Mexico, as well as our brothers and sisters in Palestine. Thank you.
My name is Carl Williams. By day, I work for the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, and a lot of the rest of my time I do legal movement work with the National Lawyers Guild of Massachusetts. That's me. Specifically today, I wanted to talk about a declaration, because we're talking about declarations today, right? So 241 years ago, a declaration was drafted, right, by some British folks, right? And it was a colonizing declaration, right? It was an explicitly racist declaration. And actually, I closed my phone, but now I need to open it and get back to the quote from that to connect to what my sister Matoi said. Just quoting from that declaration, It says, he, speaking about the King of England, he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and he has endeavored to bring upon the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages, whose only known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. So I just say that because people probably realize that's the Declaration of Independence, which a lot of people point to when we talk about our rights in this country, right, or rights that exist for folks in this country. We point to the Declaration of Independence, and we point to the Constitution of the United States of America, which are both demonstrably and unarguably explicitly racist documents, right? The Constitution explicitly says that black people count for 3/5 of a human being, but not in terms of rights. That's for, you know, proportional representation. And it also explicitly talks about how much, and I'll actually do this as a question. Do people know what it says in the second half of that sentence about what Native people count for in terms of proportional representation? 0/5. So black folks counted for 3/5, Native folks counted for nothing, actually. And actually, those words, you actually, if you amend the Constitution, you don't take words out, you actually just add words. So those words still exist in the Constitution. I say of this country, I don't say of our country, but of that exist, because I learned that from Malcolm X, but of this country, those words still exist. You can go, you know, downtown Boston, and those words are carved in stone, you know, in the lobbies of some buildings. I used to work in the John Hancock building, and it had that, the merciless Indian savages quote, it has that in the wall where I used to work, right? Exactly, right? So I think those are some things that we need to think about. And I think some of the language in terms of this panel talked about joining of movements and having solidarity across movements, which I explicitly disagree with, right? Explicitly. But I disagree with it sort of in solidarity. I think if that makes any sense, it probably doesn't. But I think what we're really talking about is a movement that has one specific goal. And that goal, and folks have said, that goal is liberation, right? That goal is freedom. And if people know the Dream Defenders, an organization in Miami and kind of spreading nationally across the country, Umi Selah, who's a really visionary person and probably one of the best public speakers I've ever heard, they have a series of kind of revolutionary T-shirts, and one of their T-shirts says, I've been to the future. We won. Right? And that's a lot, right? I'll say it again because some people say it says, I've been to the future. We won. And that, I think, speaks to that goal of freedom, right? So to me, it is a battle. It is a struggle for liberation that takes place in different ways, in different arenas, whether that's spray painting graffiti on the wall in Palestine or spray painting graffiti on both sides of the wall in Mexico and in the United States, whether that's, you know, people protesting here in Boston or, you know, or in Puerto Rico. But we're fighting for systems that have been created at the foundational structures of these countries, of the United States and of Israel. That's, to me, Zionism and systems of white supremacy are two sides of the same coin, right? They're structures that were built to oppress people, to steal land, to steal resources, and create false senses of superiority. The system of white supremacy that was invented, whiteness was created in the United States for the United States to build wealth upon the backs primarily of people of African descent, of black people, right? Whiteness was created for that purpose. It exists for that purpose. And it arguably, that means I want to argue with you about it if you don't agree, it arguably is the single most deadly thing that has ever been created in the history of humanity, right? Nuclear weapons have not killed as many people. Even nuclear power has not killed as many people. Like, natural disasters haven't killed as many people. That structure saying, you are less than me, therefore we can kill you, we can burn you in ovens, we can steal your land, we can bomb you with napalm until, you know, a tenth of your population no longer exists. Those things become either possible or more possible because of the system of white supremacy that was invented for the structure of chattel slavery in the United States of America. And when we talk about it, just as when we talk about the structure of the occupation, theft of land, and the stealing of human rights of Palestinian and other Arab people, we need to talk about Zionism, or you cannot have that conversation. You cannot have that conversation without talking about Zionism. When we have the conversation about the United States and its this neocolonial and imperial construct around the world, we cannot have that conversation unless at the root of it we're talking about white supremacy. I'll actually just say, because it's really inspirational for me, have people seen this video that black activists in the United States and Palestinian activists created? It's called When I See Them, I See Us. People, if you haven't seen that, see it. Take a look at it. I would show it now. We don't have a lot of time, though. You should take a look at it. If you've seen it before, see it again. I just watched it again, and it really touched me. But organizations are doing that. Dream Defenders, actually, and Black Lives Matter took a delegation of folks, in addition to, you know, the delegations that Gabe was talking about, took delegations of black folks and, you know, Afro-Caribbean folks to Palestine. And people had an immediate sense of solidarity. They had a sense of solidarity before, but immediately sense a connection with the land, an immediate sense of solidarity with the struggles that were happening there and the struggles that were happening in their homes across the United States. But I think, just as an introduction, I just wanted to really say that, really, when I think of these struggles, I think of it as one struggle. If there are, you know, victories in terms of, you know, what is happening in terms of, let's say, the BDS struggle, and I actually just want to say one brief thing about the BDS struggle, and what sounds like 24, 25 states passing legislation criminalizing BDS actions in the United States. You think that's kind of bad, right? That sucks, right? It is actually, I'm going to make you think of that as a good thing, right? And I'm going to say it real frank, because I disdain respectability politics. They are afraid of us. I play chess a lot, and when you do a really good move and the other side is kind of fucked, this is what someone does. They're like, all right, I need to do something really drastic at this point. I'm going to do something really drastic. And then they do the drastic thing, and you're like, you weren't thinking when you did that. That is them responding to us. That is them losing, right? So now we're at the point I said, look, there's the structure of the Israeli state. There are activists and organizers, Palestinian-led, taking up the BDS struggle. There's us, that structure of people winning a lot of victories in that and clearly changing the dynamic of the discussion. And then they pass anti-BDS legislation, right, which should on its face appear unconstitutional. But if you're hoping for it to be unconstitutional in the court, I'll disabuse you of that notion. Just, you know, look on your phone at a picture of the United States Supreme Court. If you're investing your belief of liberation and freedom in this struggle on those people, look at a picture. And I, you know, footnote to white supremacy. Footnote to white supremacy. If you think a bunch of people in black robes whose mind, even if they're a little bit more brown or even if they're a little bit more gendered as women, and you think they're going to save you, and also the direction that it's going, it's, you know, centrist at best, diving towards the deep, deep, horrifying right. So I think that they are not going to save us. We are going to save us, right? So I just wanted to say that about BDS. We are winning. That is plays of desperation and said by people long before me. Organized people will beat organized money every single time. And one of the things I think we need to do really is dare to dream, do things in more dramatic ways, confront power in real ways, and understand that our liberation is our responsibility, and all of us are complicit in oppression in ways. And, you know, and there's a good thing about that, because then we can actually take responsibility, right? None of our state legislators, our federal legislators, the president, those people are not going to be part of this liberation. But we can force them to do less and sometimes hide it and actually once in a while do something positive. If we believe that, if we take dramatic action, we can make more people be free, and we can be an example of freedom for other folks. Thanks.
I am humbled and honored to follow the three of you and to be here with Jamila. All of you are my teachers, and I've learned so much from you today, but also in other spaces, and I'm want to take just an opportunity to thank you all for your work, for being visionaries, for being folks who also pass batons and who are willing and eager for others to take up the struggle, to learn lessons and to be better and to be stronger. I am better because of you, and I'm so thankful to be here. I've spent the last 7 years of my life. My name is Nadia Ben Youssef, and I work with the Adala Justice Project, a sister organization of Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, where I've spent the last 7 years and the first years of my human rights career and my legal career, learning from also freedom fighters and alongside Palestinians who have a vision for justice that has inspired me beyond measure. But those 7 years have also landed me often face-to-face with the anxiety of the state of Israel, face-to-face with them in interrogation rooms. And so I tell this story as a way to build upon what my colleagues and comrades have said. I'll take you to March of this year. And this has happened every time in the last 7 years that I've been able, and it's a privilege, to enter Israel, to work with Adala. But my last name is Ben Youssef, said with a U and not an O, and that becomes quite important when someone says, how do you pronounce your last name? Because Yosef is something, and Youssef is something else. I learned this only in Israel, actually. And so I answer the question, Youssef, and they say, come with us. So Youssefs go to the Arab room, as those of us who've been there and have a Youssef in our name understand, and another Arab or Muslim names or have darker skin or are perceived in some way as a threat to the status quo. So they say, come with us, and so you're in the Arab room. I've been there for the last 7 years. And what's interesting about this position is what I learn about the empire. What I learn about Israel in those spaces of interrogation. So I was there in March of this year, 2017, and I had an interrogator named Jason. And there's always a moment when the interrogation turns. After kind of the niceties of where are you from, what are you doing, what's Adala, something happens and there's a shift. You feel the air tighten around you, the temperature drops. And so in the past, starting in, say, 2010, when I was entering the country in 2010, the interrogation turned on this question. Who do you know that's organizing direct action? Are you connected with ISM, the International Solidarity Movement? Who's leading the protests in the Nakab? Who do you know in the West Bank that's organizing direct action? Who's leading those Friday protests? Who is on the ground doing that work? That's when the intensity would increase, starting in 2010. Then we're having a wave of discriminatory legislation that's passing in Israel starting in 2011. One of those was the anti-boycott law that was passed in 2011, upheld by the Israeli Supreme Court in 2015. Adala worked on this case, challenged the BDS law of Israel, and that became an obsession for the state. The state was obsessed with BDS, who I knew, what was going on, what was Adala's interest in this, what was our legal arguments, who in the United States is organizing on BDS, am I a part of the BDS movement, am I calling for boycott of Israel, do I believe in sanctions, what do you mean by divestment? The interrogation would turn on BDS. And it took us a long time. And Adala's answer, because Adala, as a Palestinian organization based in Israel, because of this law, has a prohibition on it with regard to the call for BDS. So the law says that if you call for boycott, it had created a new civil wrong. You can be sued in court if you call for a boycott of Israel. So Adala has pivoted its argument about BDS to say we are for the right to boycott. That has been my answer in interrogation. That is my answer in public forum. We support the right to boycott. And Israel, and as I understand through interrogation, has become okay with that, actually. So Jason, we're in March 2017. Why is your name Jason? I don't know. But Jason says, so tell me about BDS. This is actually part of the niceties. The interrogation didn't turn. Tell me about BDS. And I said, well, Adela supports the right to boycott. There is a right to boycott, freedom of expression. We believe in it wholeheartedly. We also believe in the pillars of the BDS movement. And I went as far as I could. And Jason said, okay. And then Jason turned away from his computer, closed his book, and looked at me and said, tell me about intersectionality. Like this. And I couldn't help it. Like, a smile erupted in my face. And I said, that's the interrogation question. And I said, well, amazingly, it started by black feminists. It's an idea that in our oppressions are interlocked. And it was actually coined by a legal scholar named Kimberly Crenshaw. He said, Nadia, that's not what I mean. You know that's not what I mean. He said, what are you doing to connect struggles that have nothing to do with each other? You're creating confusion. You're creating chaos. We as the government are completely opposed to these efforts to build solidarity and a cross-movement struggle. And I said, we are winning. In my head. I said, we are winning, to Carl's point. When you see the empire tremble, that's where you know where to push. That is where you know where to push. That is what scares the state. When it looks out and sees groups of people connected, yes, of course, by their oppression, understanding that their oppressions are linked, but who are joining forces because they believe, even more so, that their liberations are tied. That is when the system is dismantled, and that is when we win. And so when we look at our advocacy strategies moving forward, I encourage you in your own life, certainly, but as community organizers, as activists, as artists, as teachers, as human rights defenders, as politicians, as nurses, think about this. This is when we win. And I would say a few things just about what we can learn from intersectionality so that we can continue moving this conversation forward. But really, all that I wanted to say has been said. Intersectionality, actually, in the way that Jason understood it, in the way that we've talked about it as well, I mean, it has kind of two different ideas. One is kind of a popular understanding of intersectionality, which we actually are thinking about as joint struggle. When Jason said intersectionality, he was thinking less about the black feminist thought from which it comes, the academic idea of intersectionality. And he was thinking more about cross-movement building and the idea that this is one struggle. That's what he was thinking about. And in fact, it's interesting that those terms have been conflated, because we can learn a lot from the analysis of intersectionality within our movements. And in fact, our joint struggle, or our one struggle, is strengthened, is protected from fragmentation, actually can win when we have an intersectional analysis. When we center the experiences of those most impacted by oppression, when we center Native history and Native visions of liberation, then you start understanding exactly what world we're trying to create. So I think, and actually Giacomo, I don't know if you're still here, but Giacomo asked a great question when he was looking at the Arab Spring. And he asked, you know, how can we make sure that we're not replicating systems of oppression in our movements, in our liberation, in our freedom? And that is the intersectional analysis. And of course, a young person is bringing that up as his question and saying, that's what I'm concerned about. How do I know that everyone will get free and not just those who are buying into neocolonial models, as you said, Giacomo, those who are benefiting from systems of economic systems, neoliberal models. So they're asking us really to think differently about what liberation looks like. So centering the most impacted is a critical conversation that comes from intersectionality and should be the way that we organize our movements. Intersectionality also tells us something about how trauma can coexist with privilege. Intersectionality demands that of us. Where, as Carl said, are we complicit in systems of oppression? What do we need to relinquish about our own power and our own privilege in order for all of us to be liberated? And I think that becomes really important, and it becomes important with the story of Israel as well. Trauma can coexist with power and privilege. That's what intersectionality tells us. And I want to move a little bit to just kind of my own analysis and how it has shifted my understanding of my work in the United States. So Adela, 3 years ago, said, go to the U.S., map the movement, see where we should intervene, what does it look like to build a mass movement for Palestinian rights, and to kind of shift American discourse and ultimately policy. And so initially I was doing kind of, well, where are we actually working now? And was seeing at the time in 2013, you know, a lot of focus on convincing the oppressor, demanding that those in power recognize the humanity of those who of whom they've stripped that power, recognize our humanity. And that was our target as a movement. We were saying, please, like, and we were going like this. We were lifting up, going to those with the power. What has happened over time, and, you know, we spoke about it, and Yusuf mentioned it in the summer of 2014, and how our movement has shifted, is suddenly we said, we're going to stop doing that. The power is actually when we do this. This is where the power is. And what we're doing is not advocating to those with power to relinquish a bit of power, because it's creating an alternative nexus of power. Say that again.
No, sorry. I said the one we want.
That's the one we want. No, it's totally right. Build like this. See in your life where you are building like this and reaching and asking, and build like this, where the power is real. And so in that, our advocacy strategy kind of shifted. And what we said is we need to de-exceptionalize Israel-Palestine in American discourse. De-exceptionalize Israel-Palestine. This is not a unique issue that history has nothing to say about, that we have no progressive or no value system that can really absorb what's happening in Israel-Palestine. In fact, we do. You have all the tools at your disposal. So on one hand, I love and I'm grateful, and I took 18 pages of notes from the scholars and researchers who led us and grounded our discussion today. But oftentimes, complexity is also a tool of empire. Complexity is a tool of empire. It makes us think, I can never know that much. I can never study that much. I didn't write a book. I don't have a PhD. I'm not Jewish. I'm not Palestinian. How in the world can I have an opinion on this issue? And I say you have an opinion because you are a human being and you understand the value of what that means. And so we need to de-exceptionalize Israel-Palestine, demystify. This is not complicated. It might be difficult, in that it is always difficult to wrest power from those who have stolen it. That's difficult. That's not complicated. And then on the last point, I will say, just for us to start thinking, and as we're moving into the workshops and we're building advocacy strategies, we're starting to understand exactly what our role is now in this moment, which is different. It's different, and it's better, because we can learn from history. Certainly, joint struggle is not a new idea. It's not a new idea. Our elders have been engaged in this since the beginning of struggle, recognizing that our liberation is tied. But with this intersectional analysis, we have something better. We have something better, and we have a protection from the fragmentation, from the discord that is generated when certain people within movements have more power than others. So we have a tool. And I would just say, this might be also kind of moving away from respectability, which is the way we should go for sure. But we've talked a lot about PEPs in our movement. PEPs, which are progressive on everything but Palestine. PEPs, okay? So we thought, okay, this is the problematic thing. We have to show them that they're actually not progressive. We have to try to align their progressive values with the liberation of Palestine. And I would say, okay, so that's an issue, certainly. PEPs are an issue. But more problematic to me now, and I hope to us in the future and moving forward, are what we call POOPs. And POOPs are progressive only on Palestine. Progressive only on Palestine. And to those, I say, there's the door. If you are here because you believe that Palestinians alone deserve liberation, you are not part of this movement. If you are here because You believe that Palestinians should be free at the expense of others. You are not part of this movement. If you are homophobic, you are not part of this movement. If you are supporting institutions and ideologies of white supremacy, you are not part of this movement. You are part of this movement if you stand for Native liberation. You are part of this movement if you stand for Black power. You are part of this movement if you are here because this is a global struggle for justice, that we are part of a community that struggles for justice, and that is why you are here. If there's any other reason, there's the door. This movement is huge. We are numerous, but we are numerous when we realize that we are interconnected, that our struggles are tied, and that our liberation is only ours when we are there together. Thank you.
You have been listening to Matoi Monroe, Gabriel Camacho, Carl Williams, and Nadia Ben-Youssef, who comprise the powerful intersectionality panel of the Balfour Legacy Conference held in Cambridge, Massachusetts on November 11, 2017. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. How likely is the Israeli government able to kill Palestinians, safe in the knowledge the British press and the left won't dare speak out against them? Yes, the worrying is Israel's secret program to skew debate on Wikipedia and reporting online as it uses its armed forces against civilians on the ground. Also, as technology races forwards, and the last people to notice seems to be our MPs and congressmen and women, there is no UK or international law really governing lethal autonomous weapons, that's killer robots to you and me, with chilling adverts showing how easy it is for a drone to kill anyone, to order. Where is the law? What's the UN doing? And why are Google employees and academics in the US putting pressure on Google to disengage from its private military contracts, which could see your online browsing behaviour used to add you to the latest drone kill list? But first, another good cause, Bites the Dust, campaign for press and broadcasting freedom, along with its periodical Free Press, copies of which are available in our studio here, will be closing down on or by the end of November this year. We're joined tonight by Mike Jempson. He's arguably the Bristol contingent, a man who's been there almost from the start of the campaign, set up a journalism rights charity himself, media-wise, here in Bristol. So why is the campaign for press and broadcasting freedom folding, just as UK press freedom and diversity is arguably at its lowest ebb? Our sister show Dialect's back on BCFM, 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now if you want at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, Glastonbury Abbey is open for business, with a whole lot being found out all the time about the early Christian settlements on the site and also the reasons why Henry VIII wanted to make it the ruin it is today. Part one of a two-part round tour of the Abbey and its history. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk now. But first, I'm joined by Mike Jempson from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. Mike, you also set up a charity here in the city. Can you tell us about some of the early days of this campaign? I think it's 40 years old, isn't it?
It'll be 40 years old next year. It was started in 1978 during the Winter of Discontent, as it was lovingly called by the Daily Mirror, at a time when the unions and progressive activists were getting a pretty hard time from the mainstream press, not to mention the Labour Party. And there was a lot of anxiety amongst print workers and journalists about what was happening. And so the campaign, which was originally called the Campaign for Press Freedom, was set up by a group of journalists and academics and trade union activists. And by the way, it's not sort of closing down. That's certainly not by choice. I mean, the big reason for that is the lack of funding. So much has changed, which we perhaps can go into. But although we just do not have the money to carry on, to sustain an office and staff, the campaigning will continue, but in other forms.
But the Winter of Discontent, I mean, certainly the way most people look back on it now is that this was really the unions overstretching themselves, causing so much trouble that they ended up being hated more than the government was back at the end of the 70s.
Well, it depends who you're talking to, I think. I mean, you'll find that one of the big problems was their causes were being so poorly represented. And, of course, at the time, unions were not very good at handling the media themselves, so it was always an afterthought. And things did get out of hand, it's true, and it was a difficult period. In fact, I was a young journalist at the time, and we were on strike throughout the winter of 1978 because our employers, we then had a national wage agreement, as did many unions, and our employers, the Newspaper Publishers Association, were not willing to negotiate. So we weren't the only ones. There were public sector workers on strike as well. Things did get very unpleasant. And, of course, it's always the unions that get the blame.
The union was on strike for how long were you on strike for then?
The NEJ members were on strike, I think, for 7 weeks, if I remember rightly.
So that means no news, does it? In various outlets.
This was a national strike of provincial newspapers. So it was the local press that was on strike. Some of the publications still came out rather thinly, run by their managements, and some scab labour. But for the most part, they weren't being published. We, for instance, in East London, were publishing our own little newsletter. And subsequently, we set up a thing called East End News as a cooperative venture to provide an alternative view of what was happening in East London at the time.
Now, the 1970s were a very different time because it was really the 80s that the technology changed, and we started getting digital printing, that sort of thing, particularly with Rupert Murdoch sort of leading the way. What was the relationship like between the journalists' unions and the print unions back in the 70s?
Well, of course, it was Eddie Shah who was used to launch a newspaper today using the new technology. And, of course, one of the big problems was that journalists were used. There was a whole process which involved a variety of different print unions in producing newspapers at the time. And a lot of employers, for instance, were not very keen on bringing computers into the newsroom. I started out on a typewriter, and it took a very long time for computers to come into the newsroom. And then you had the problem that you were able to produce copy which didn't need to be reset by the printers. And what happened was the initial antipathy between the two groups of workers was resolved by a lot of very difficult negotiation, which included the idea of merger. And quite a few print workers actually, including some who were very active in the campaign, became journalists too.
So the difference in the technique, what was it between the hot metal days and the somehow a journalist types something and then it automatically gets put onto...
Gradually you reach the point where, as now, I mean, I was, for instance, producing community newspapers, and indeed the Campaign for Press Freedom's newsletter for 3 years, cutting and pasting typed material on my kitchen table. And then that would go off to be photographed and then made into plates. So it was a very, very different style of working to what you have now with sort of systems within newspapers, which are like a sort of formulaic way of producing a page, what it looks like, how many words you're going to get on that page. Whereas when I started out, you had to know the width of each letter, especially when making up headlines. And it was, you know, the skill set you needed was very, very different.
When the Campaign for Press and Broadcast Freedom first started, what was your... Did you have any specific aims? Did you have anything particularly in mind to try and achieve?
There were a series of very important issues which remain just as apposite now. One of them was about plurality, the need for a variety of different types of publication and different systems of ownership, as well as different owners, because even then there was a very limited range of owners of a very limited range of, if you like, political views in the mainstream press, most of whom were opposed to the Labour Party and the Labour movement in particular. So that was one thing, the whole issue of ownership and control. And another was the right of reply, because in those days you had, particularly when you're talking about industrial disputes or progressive movements like CND, for instance, and peace movements, you'd get very, very negative coverage, and there was no guarantee that people would be asked for their point of view. The same was true, too, about reporting on ethnic minorities. So newspapers are quite happy to produce what we would now consider to be racist copy and never think about asking black people or gypsies, for instance, what their point of view was. So one of the big issues for the campaign was to get a statutory right of reply. And I think it's worth pointing out that, for instance, in France and Belgium, there's been a right of reply if a newspaper gets things wrong since the 19th century. And most European countries have got a right of reply so that if a newspaper gets things wrong, they're expected to allow the person who they've misrepresented to give their point of view soon afterwards. And the campaign has written and developed a whole series, I think five different bills to try and get a statutory right of reply in this country.
But no success?
No, they've had all-party support, but they've been attacked, of course, by the mainstream press throughout, and none have got beyond a second reading. I was particularly involved with... the first one was with Frank Alorne in about 1983-84, and then you had Tony Worthington, you had Anne Cluid, later you had Peter Bradley and Austin Mitchell. But the bill I got most involved with was Clive Soley's Press Freedom and Responsibility Bill. And we organised in Parliament special hearings where members of the public who'd been trounced by the press and the regulator then, the Press Complaints Commission, and the print unions were invited to come and talk through some of the issues. It was a very unusual proceeding. The bill, however, fell at the second reading, as it usually does in these cases. And we then gathered 70 different people and organisations who'd had a hard time from the press in Parliament, and they were invited, or the press were invited, to meet them. Not a single journalist turned up. So the people present then got very angry, and they came up with ideas for an organisation to take the place of the body that Clive Soley had been proposing, and that's how PressWise, now MediaWise, got started.
Very frustrating, isn't it? It seems that the press have got something they want to tell people. They don't always want to listen.
Well, I mean, These are difficult things, especially nowadays when everybody sort of shouts and hollers about fake news. Most of the stuff in newspapers is not fake news. There is stuff, which I've been exposing through MediaWise for many years now, which is not complete or which is deliberately misdirecting people. But it's interesting that for all the fact that I've spent much of my career criticising the media, my colleagues in the NUJ have recognised how valuable this sort of work is. And I've been awarded a gold medal by the union and, in fact, life membership now for the work that I've done on trying to promote journalistic ethics, because most journalists want to be able to tell the truth and not to be subjected to the sorts of pressure that often happens in national newspaper newsrooms.
I mean, we're talking about the old hot metal days, and also, of course, the ownership here of the Bristol Post used to be locally owned. In fact, it was set up originally to be a locally owned newspaper, wasn't it?
Well, most were. But in fact, in the 1920s, when there were all sorts of problems, as you know, in terms of the economy, what you got was a sort of gentleman's agreement between the various different, mostly family firms that ran local papers. And I think there were two or three in Bristol then. They sort of agreed that everybody would have a town each, and that's how we got the Evening Post as it is now. Now, the ironical thing is that when at the time the campaign started, the Evening Post was one of the best local papers to work for. It had very good reputation, it had excellent wages, had a lot of staff. It was the sort of paper people wanted to be on. Sadly, that's no longer the case.
What's changed?
Well, ownership for a start. I mean, ownership has changed hands several times.
It's gone over to Daily Mail, first of all, and then now to
and out of the Mirror Group, Trinity. Well, that's changed its name too now. And it had, at one time...
Interestingly, with the same editor.
Yeah,
From Northcliffe, which is the Daily Mail, to the Mirror, you'd expect that there'd be a change of editor. No.
No. Newspaper owners employ the editors they think will do their whim. And once upon a time, the Evening Post, for instance, had a former Guardian associate editor as its editor and was a very feature-full newspaper. So lots of in-depth stuff and longer pieces of journalism. They then hired a tabloid editor who completely transformed the paper and, in doing so, very interestingly, expanded the readership. So it became a much more popular paper, and that's a good thing. But it also became very formulaic, and they got rid of all the feature writers. And now you get very little coverage of the local authority, for instance. There isn't enough staff to do things in depth. And so the Evening Post now has had to rely on what are called the democracy reporters, paid for by the BBC out of our... licence fee payers' money.
Well, it's interesting. We still call it the Evening Post, don't we? That's actually the Bristol Post. It stopped being an evening paper quite a while ago, but that...
Well, yes, once it was had three issues a day and several on Saturday and the Pinkun and the Greenun, etc. Yeah, it's a very changed beast.
Somebody that worked in the early days of the Post when it was still hot metal, that is to say, a different style of print room where individual compositors would make up the printing blocks from little bits of metal, that is to say, with letters on them, they would make up the stories. One of the people that used to work there was a chap called Dennis Pater, and I spoke to him a few years ago as part of something called the National Union of Journalists Oral History Project. And here he is just giving us a flavour of what life was like back before they went over to the digital press.
For a whole generation now, they have only known the Evening Post and Western Daily Press to be up at Temple Way. Whereabouts was it in Broadmead?
Opposite the Odeon, down the bottom of the hill there. And in fact, the building as such is still there, opposite the fire station, next to the Bridewell police station. The building is still there with shops on the ground floor level and offices above. So they've utilised the building. Well, and
now, most of us know what a modern newsroom looks like. Give us you've already told us a little bit, but give us a sort of sweep round the newsroom in those days. Maybe talking about the 1960s, I guess.
Well, certainly from the journalist's point of view, they all seem to be huddled together in very small rooms with banks of paper on spikes everywhere and cluttered desks of newspapers and paper and typewriters clattering away, and all the guys seem to be smoking in those days, and ties undone round their waists. Some guys would wear the visor shades, like you see in some of these films. And but there was a great atmosphere. And in the composing room, again, it was very noisy with the hot metal. And on audition time, a journalist, a sub, would come down to the composing room to sub the page, a great big hot metal page, and he'd stand on what was called the stone, the other side of the stone from the compositor. And he would instruct the compositor what changes he'd made. He'd have his galley proofs, as they were called, that were pulled and inked up the type and pulled, so that the journalist had his galley proof to make his late corrections. Sometimes there wasn't time for all the corrections to go. They had to go without them. But in the old days, there was the barrier where the NGA wouldn't let anybody else touch the type. And that applied to the journalists as well. And one former editor of the Evening Post, who will remain nameless, showed me a permanent dent he had on the back of his hand, where one day he went to touch the type and he was warned not to. And a few minutes later, he did touch the type and he was hit on the back of the hand with a wooden mallet. So, the demarcation was very strict in those days.
As someone who's been working here as well recently, you talked about the atmosphere in the old paper. How has the atmosphere changed over the years?
Well, it's very much seems library-like to me now. It's very quiet, unless a really big news story breaks.
Very quiet. But what interests me, Mike, is this whole idea of the editor not actually getting involved, that really the journalist and the compositor there are the only two people who are involved in writing that story. Nowadays, the journalist will press the button and anything could happen to that story. It can be edited, it can be subbed and changed before it actually reaches the newspaper.
No, I think you've got that quite right. In fact, at the time that being talked about there, you'd also have a reader. So once the stuff had been typed up and set and the galley proof had been produced, which was like a sort of rough print, you'd have a reader who was not a journalist, who was one of the print unions, who would sort of check it for obvious spelling errors, etc., and might draw attention to those. And then you'd have a sub who'd go down and point out that this and that had to be changed. But, I mean, the editor had overall charge and would normally have passed, either him or one of his deputies, and they were mostly men, would have passed the proofs down to be published. I think one of the sad things about here in Bristol is that the old print room, or the new print room, if you like, at the post buildings, has now gone.
That's sort of Temple Way.
It's now office blocks, and it shows, you know, what the real interests of these huge corporations that own the media are really interested in. I mean, they're vast corporations who have lots of other interests, some of which one could say, and this was one of the main points of the campaign, was that, you know, that might actually interfere with the nature of the coverage that they might give. So, for instance, if I own a newspaper and I also own forests, oil fields, transport systems, maybe even hotel systems. So I might have interest in a whole range of things which are linked to the print industry, but which in fact have got their own economic lifestyle, and I may not want people interfering with that. So how do the financial journalists, for instance, on a newspaper, deal with other companies that are linked to their to the company that they're working for? Raises some very interesting problems. So in terms of transparency and accountability, these were the sorts of things that the campaign wanted to draw attention to. And we did a huge amount of work in helping people to understand the links between these industries and who really owns the newspapers, and not just the newspapers. Here in Bristol, for instance, at one time, you had the Daily Mail behind the local paper,
They're also behind the sort of electronic news systems that you've got on your television in those days. What was that called?
CFAX,
etc. They also had shares in the local TV company. So without realising it, people were actually, and the Western Daily Press, of course, and the Free Weekly Observer. So people weren't aware that much of the stuff they were getting was originated from one source, and that source was not local journalists. It was a news company based in London, with owned by people who lived abroad and had their money fixed abroad, and they weren't even paying British tax. And that makes a big difference when you think about what it is you're supposed to be reading in the papers and who sets the news agenda.
Well, I mean, it's like something like Brexit, for example. I wonder whether some of the newspaper owners had a mind to what was going to happen with their tax havens depending on what the result of the Brexit vote was.
Well, far be it from me to say that that would influence what they might have to say about Brexit, but it's pretty clear that the level of hypocrisy amongst those people who own our newspapers is hard to quantify.
Has it been concentrating over the 40 years the CPBF's been around into fewer hands, or is it diversified?
Because we've got the internet. Not at all. There is diversification in the sense that there are many more local initiatives, for instance, and you have to watch out, because if you get a successful local initiative, do you remember here in Bristol we had Our School magazine, for instance, which was a really interesting idea developed by some parents. And they sort of created a magazine which would be centred on children's school leads. That was so successful that it got bought up by the Evening Post, and that before it disappeared altogether. So it's successful.
Bought up
local,
and shut down.
Eventually, partly because of the result of a rather bizarre scandal. That's one of the difficulties. If you are able to produce a medium which is successful and is attracting advertising, like the first community radio station here in Bristol, it'll get bought out and changed because it's discovered a niche from which money could be made. And that's the key issue about most media companies. They're about making money, not about the journalism.
What about some of the recent cases? We had journalist Mark Watts on here a few weeks ago talking about the Cliff Richard verdict. The BBC, I'm not sure if they've decided whether they want to appeal yet, but this is really effectively saying that even if it's quite true what a newspaper, or in this case the BBC, is saying, in this case about Cliff Richard's house being raided, that they're not allowed to report it. I mean, I wonder what you make of that.
That's not quite what the ruling said or was about. And in fact, very little has been said about the nurse who was identified as the person considered to be at the centre of the deaths at a hospital. If you remember, there were a series of deaths, children's deaths at a hospital, and several of the newspapers not only named but published pictures of the nurse who was supposed to be involved in this. We don't know. She's never been charged. But as with the Cliff Richard thing, so far as I was concerned, and I've written about this, the big issue there was whether or not the BBC should have hired a helicopter and flown over the property and filmed the police in the property. That was highly sensational. It was unnecessary. It would have been perfectly proper for them to report that the police were going to investigate or to search his house, even though no charges had been laid. And if they'd left it there, I don't think they'd have had half the problems that they've got now. It was the intrusive way that they tried to cut out any opposition, any competition, and show that they had sort of snapped this exclusive that was the real problem.
I mean, isn't there a bit of a problem developing, Mike, that when you're wealthy, it's actually easier to take the press to court? I mean, this is true over libel and things like that. Wealthy people are a threat to editors. They bite their nails. They say, oh, should we run this story or not if someone's wealthy? Whereas if someone's poor, they're, forgive the phrase, easy meat for the tabloids.
Yeah, I think it's slightly more complicated than that. It is a fact, though, for instance, that if you live on a council estate, for instance, or in a terrace, your privacy is much less easy to protect than if you live in a gated community or behind high walls, or indeed if you've got a great deal of money. The libel laws have actually been liberalised in some ways, although the idea of ordinary people being able to use the sort of no win, no fee has changed a bit. But it's always been the case that those people who are wealthy can stop stories appearing. And indeed, I think one of the things that I would like to know more about, and if we're talking about transparency, is how many cases have there been where newspapers have not run stories because they've been contacted by wealthy solicitors or solicitors of wealthy people and persuaded not to run a story. It's much more difficult to do that if you're an ordinary person with no public standing, if you like. And they're the sort of people that I've been dealing with at MediaWise for the last 25 years. And they get a rough deal and very often have very little chance of getting redress.
With all your experience of doing this, Mike, are there one or two changes that you'd still like to see? Just simple changes that would actually make a big difference?
Well, very complicated, really. I mean, I think first of all, it would be a very good idea if there were more transparency about who owns the press. I think that organisations such as the so-called Independent Press Standards Organisation were much more open about not only the way it handles complaints, but also having working journalists involved. At the moment, it's a club which does have public sector or members of the public represented there, but it's still very much an editor's club. And it doesn't really provide the opportunity that so many people want to actually talk to people about the issues that have been raised by bad coverage. So you don't have the opportunity for sort of oral hearings, which you used to have once upon a time with the Broadcasting Standards Council, for instance. And that made a huge difference. So that sort of thing, I think, would make a big difference. I think the right of reply shouldn't be a fear for the press. I mean, they have misrepresented Leveson and Leveson's recommendations. They misrepresented the right of reply, and it shouldn't be a problem, because if you don't get things wrong, if you don't deliberately misrepresent what people say, you wouldn't have to offer people a right of reply. So it's a question of getting things right, or as close to right as possible first time, and then admitting it when you've got things wrong. And at MediaWise, we have a very simple credo. We say that press freedom is a responsibility exercised by journalists on behalf of the public. It doesn't belong to the owners or to the editors. It belongs to the public. And the public have a right to be told when the media get things wrong. And that way we would be able to kill off all this nonsense about fake news. And if our journalists were, how should we put it, freer to be able to challenge some of the nonsense that both politicians and people like Trump bellow at us, maybe people would have a bit more confidence in the media. And that's the saddest thing, is that people have lost confidence in good journalism.
Well, it's in a way a pity you said that today, Mike, because Trump has just been proved right, hasn't he, today? Because there were stories about him arriving 15 minutes late to see the Queen. Everyone, including the BBC, has had a good look into that, and they found that actually the Queen was 15 minutes early. So it was
no
fake news.
I have no idea or interest in the behaviour of monarchs or Trump when he's visiting them, I'm afraid. I think there are much more serious things to concern ourselves with.
I mean, the fake news is, I mean, this was really started year before last at a press conference by, as I remember, Merkel and Obama talking about fake news in the presidential election campaign, in the US presidential election campaign. And that was actually at the same time that Google were doing something. Do you think there's anything real being done about, I mean, what we're talking about effectively is lies, you know, and it's not just coming out of the internet, it's also coming out of the press as well, with things like weapons of mass destruction before the Iraq war.
Well, it wasn't the press who talked about weapons of mass destruction. That came from politicians, don't forget. And it may have been, it may well be, I think it is right to say that the press didn't do enough to challenge that. And it is our job as journalists to challenge and to check, especially what politicians say, and especially when, you know, people's lives are at risk. But I mean, fake news has been around for a very long time. Indeed, the first code of conduct produced for journalists in this country was back in 1884. And it was done by the gentlemen of the press, who disliked the yellow press of the day and wanted to show that they were a cut above all these people who were writing sensational stories based on court cases, sex and violence stories in the, or what we'd call the tabloid, but there were sort of penny dreadfuls. And so they set up an organisation, which still exists today, the Institute of Journalists, and developed a sort of code of conduct, which eventually would be changed into the NUJ's code at a later stage. But journalists themselves are the ones who are saying, we've got to make sure that we have some integrity and some ethics about what we do. Unfortunately, a commercial press, with all the pressures that are involved, especially with 24-hour rolling news, what happens is everybody wants to get in on the act, and it's not who's right, it's who's first that seems to be more important.
Okay, it's crystal ball time, Mike. What with Leveson being only very semi-effective after this horrendous phone, I mean, it was awful, the phone hacking scandal where you've got people's answer phones being hacked into. The idea was, oh, we're going to have to get a better press as a result of it. Very little really seems to have changed. What's your view of the future?
Well, I mean, I think for a start, one of the things that's really encouraging is how many local initiatives, like here in Bristol, have been developed, partly because the mainstream has been shedding journalists like nobody's business. So we have things like Bristol Cable and Bristol 24/7 and the Voice Network here, all of which are initiatives from journalists who had been working at the Post. That's a very encouraging development. I'm a little nervous about encouraging the internet as the only way forward, but it's certainly very interesting to see how direct contact seems to make a difference. But you need a lot more media literacy for people to be able to understand what's happening if they're only getting their news from Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or whatever. So I think that the other thing that's interesting is I've been working in Europe with other groups of people in about 14 different countries, and there are similar concerns there and similar interests in new types of media initiative, which could hopefully make a big difference.
Well, what they're saying, Facebook, people like that, is that, oh, well, in social media now we're taking fake news very seriously. We will have fake news monitors.
Yeah, I believe they've got several hundred thousand people allegedly checking things, but who these people are and what experience they've got. It's a bit like the fact that local newspapers have, or many newspapers, have done away with subs. And subs were usually the old hacks whose legs had gone, but who knew a thing or two and could look at a story and see whether it really stood up. And they knew the local area and the local streets and some of the local people, so they could really had a sort of wise eye over what was being published. Now we find that sub-editing, if it's done at all, is done a long way from where the newspapers are being produced or where the readers are. So all sorts of errors creep in. And I think that, you know, we need to see a lot more investment in proper journalism. Journalism is a career that lots of people want to go in for. I've been teaching it for the last 10 years at UWE, and there's no shortage of students, but there is a shortage of jobs. There are plenty of people who can do the jobs if only the newspapers would actually invest in journalism.
I mean, since the demise, many would say, of the unions, since, you know, the 1970s, slowly but surely, more and more difficult to keep your job. Do you think that makes a difference when it comes to what journalists write about, whether they can write what they in conscience want to, or whether they're constantly thinking, crikey, if I say this, I might lose my job?
Well, I mean, partly it's to do with employment contracts. I mean, a lot of journalists are on short-term contracts, especially in media, and that does inhibit their willingness to take risks, for instance, or to cover problematic stories. Certainly the unions have changed dramatically, so all the print unions are now sort of folded into one big union which incorporates all sorts of other interests too, and that's one of the reasons why the campaign has begun to lose money, because you've got not lots of different members but one big member, and that limits the amount of funds that might be available. Excuse me. But the positive thing is that there's a whole new generation. I mean, I'm an old hack. There's a whole new generation of young people, the sort of people who'll be at the Byline Festival in a couple of weeks' time, who are seeing the world very differently, who are much more into direct action themselves, who are much more interested in working on both single issues, but also seeing the links between different issues. And, you know, at the campaign's last AGM, we were talking about the fact that this is, you know, probably the way forward, and the campaigning will now be done through those sorts of organisations like Byline, and also through the fact that the Academy has taken a more of an interest in the what's called the sort of political economy of the media, and so are able to do the research and produce information which will help people to understand more what's going on.
So it's not that the campaigning's gone, it's just the campaign.
The particular campaign, it's a bit like media-wise, it's very, very difficult to get funding. When you've got a lot of publicity around something like the Hacked Off campaign, I mean, that began to sort of drain any financial support that we were able to get. I still provide a service for people who are having difficulties with the media, but there's no funding in ethics, and we've also found that there's also no funding in, if you like, political campaigning. It's very interesting, though. There have been 5 right of reply bills, okay? They didn't come to anything, but it kept the issue alive. And if you look at some of the parliamentary debates, some of the things that were being said 20, 30 years ago are still true now. The only people who don't seem to get the message are the media owners. The Campaign for Freedom of Information, which sort of spun off from the CPBF, has been very effective in getting us freedom of information legislation. Article 19, promoting freedom of expression, also sort of took on some of the things that the campaign was working on, and has been very effective, not just in this country, but internationally. So, you know, there are lots of very positive things that have come out of the work that we've done over the last 40 years.
The one anomaly in all of this is the BBC. Do you think they'll survive?
Well, it's an interesting beast, and I think I was very interested many years ago, although I never belonged to a political party. I was part of a group that helped to produce a policy for the Labour Party on the BBC Charter. It was a very interesting document, which I did the final edit on. And sometime later, I happened to be involved in discussions at the BBC about something else. And somebody, one of the senior executives, started talking to me about some ideas which I thought I recognised. And at the time, I think we were coming up to an election. I can't remember whether it was the 92 election, where there was a possibility of a Labour government. And all of a sudden, these executives were talking around the very issues that was in this document. So they'd got hold of it, and they were seeing where was the, you know, how the writing was on the wall, and so they ought to be in line with what the thinking of a potential new government. Of course, that went out the window as soon as Labour didn't win that particular election. And I think that one of the things we've got at the moment is an anxiety within the BBC about how they do survive, and that means sort of playing along with the prevalent establishment view of what they should be doing.
Well, that's easy for them to do, really, with the various chairmen that they've had over the last few years from the City of London. David Clementi is the latest chairman of the BBC, former from Clymworth Benson, who were well known as the big privatisers. So it does seem to be that the establishment has got financial whiz kids running the corporation these days.
Well, unfortunately, that's been the case since the Peacock report back in the 1980s. Although Mr. Burt, who was the Director General at one time, had some quite good ideas about the mission to explain, he also helped to bring in this idea of the internal market, which really destroyed the notion of creativity and risk-taking inside the BBC.
Well, I'll have to agree with you, because I was there at the time. Nobody liked it, and it completely... Well, basically, we worked around it.
Mm. Well, not anymore.
No.
And whilst I think it's been quite good that independent production has become more of a feature of BBC programming, I think that's, you know, it's now become much more a part of it. I think it was once 25%. I think it's a much higher percentage now. I think all the controversy about the cost of talent has not done the BBC much good. But it also means that, you know, they really are in a competitive market, and that, you know, the amount of money they can pay becomes the important thing rather than the notion of some sort of public service, which is what it's supposed to be.
I hope you're listening, BBC. Anyway, thanks very much, Mike Jempson, for taking us through some of the trials and tribulations of 40 years of the campaign for press and broadcasting freedom. And I guess that the easiest way to find out what Mike's been up to is go through the MediaWise website, and that is still... Or follow Mike on Twitter. And if you have been maligned by the press, Mike's your man.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we're going to take a look at lethal autonomous weapons. And here is a little extract from a film about it, which is just out, in fact, a podcast. We start by looking at where the law is on these killer robots at the moment. And the chat we're going to hear from now is Peter Asaro from New York City University.
A lot of the work I've been doing under a grant for the Future of Life Institute looks at liability in increasingly autonomous systems. And within a civilian domestic application, of course, the big application that everybody's looking at the moment is the self-driving car. So you can ask this question, who's responsible when the self-driving car creates an accident? And the way that liability law works, of course, somebody somewhere is always going to wind up being responsible. The law will find a way to hold somebody responsible. The question is whether existing precedents and the ways of doing things under current legal frameworks is really just, or is really the best way going forward as we have these kinds of increasingly autonomous systems. So in terms of holding persons responsible and liable, so under tort law, if you have an accident, then you can sue somebody. So this is criminal law, this is the law of torts. And under that, then you sort of receive monetary compensation for damages done. But ideally, the person or agents or company or what have you that causes the harm is the one that should pay. Of course, that's not always true. And the way that liability works does things like joint and several liability, in which even though one party only had a small hand in causing a harm, they may have lots of money, like a government or a state or a city or something like that. And so they may actually wind up paying far more as a share of damages than they actually contributed to a problem. You also have situations of strict liability, such that even if your agency in causing a problem was very limited, you can still be held fully responsible for the implications. There's some interesting parallels here with the keeping of animals, which are kind of autonomous systems in a sense. They have their minds of their own. They sort of do things. On the other hand, we expect them to be well-behaved and well-trained, at least for domestic animals. So generally speaking, you have liability for harms caused by your dog or your horse and so forth as a domesticated animal. But you don't have strict liability. So you actually have to show that maybe you've trained your dog to attack, or you've failed to, you know, properly train your horse or keep it in a stable or what have you. Whereas if you keep a tiger or something like that and it gets out and causes harm, then you're strictly liable. So the question is, for a robot, should you be strictly liable for the robots that you create or the robots that you own? Should corporations that manufacture these systems be strictly liable for all of the accidents of self-driving cars? And while that seems like a good policy from the perspective of the public, because all the harms that are caused by these systems will be compensated, that could also stifle innovation. In the car sector, that doesn't seem to be a problem. As it turns out, the president of Volvo said that they will accept strict liability for all of their self-driving cars. Tesla Motors has, you know, released a number of autopilot systems for their cars and more or less accepted the liability for that, although there's only been a few accidents. So the actual jurisprudence or case law is still really emerging around that. But those are, I think, a technology where the cars are very expensive. There's a lot of money to be made in self-driving cars. And so the expectation of the car companies is that there will be very few accidents and that they can really afford to pay the damages for all those accidents. Now, is that going to be true for personal robots? So if you have a personal assistant, sort of butler robot who maybe goes on shopping errands and things like that for you, there's a potential for them to cause significant economic damage. They're probably not going to be nearly as expensive as cars, hopefully. And it's not clear that the market for them is going to be as big. And it's not clear that companies would be able to absorb the costs of strict liability. So there's a question of whether that's really the best policy for those kinds of systems.
Yeah, so that's Peter Osoro from New York City University. Also, we have Martin. I'll just bring you in on this, because the United Nations are looking at this, and the Conventional Weapons Convention, a dreadfully named thing that they're looking at the moment. It's mainly, apparently, the United States, Israel and Russia, who are the three countries that are holding up agreements on these autonomous weapons.
Well, I must admit it's an area in which I'm still learning, as many people are.
I think the whole world is thinking the same, aren't they?
It's not surprising that they're developing autonomous weapons. I mean, from a military point of view, you can see why you'd develop them. They don't have morale problems.
That's right.
And, that's probably the sort of thing that they're considering.
Anyway, another thing that Peter Osoro looked at was the links between Google and these drone companies, these autonomous weapon companies, the killer robot firms. And this obviously is extremely worrying. And it's interesting to see that a whole load of Google employees have kicked off against their management about these military contracts.
The Pentagon really has trouble, I think, attracting talent. There's, you know, a really strong demand for artificial intelligence researchers and developers right now, because there's so many applications and there's so much business opportunity around it. It actually turns out the military opportunities are not nearly as lucrative as a lot of the other business applications. Google and Amazon and Facebook and Microsoft can offer enormous salaries to people with PhDs in machine learning or even just master's degrees or some experience in systems development. And the Pentagon can't compete with that on government salaries. And I think they're even having trouble getting, you know, certain contracts with these companies. But when they get a contract with a company like Google, then they're able to get access to really the top talent in artificial intelligence and their cloud research groups and engineering and, also the sort of enormous capacity computationally of Google that has these massive data centers and processing capabilities. And then you're also getting, in some ways, I mean, Google is a company that collects data about people all over the world every day, all the time, every Google search that you do. And there's millions of Google searches per second or something in the world, right? So they have also the potential of applying data that's collected from the public in all these complicated ways. It's really a kind of a unique company in these respects. And I think as a company that collects that kind of private data, they also have a certain obligation to society to ensure that that data isn't used in detrimental ways. And siding with a single military in the world and using data that might be coming from users in countries where that military is operating, I think that's deeply problematic. And we, as academics, kind of lined up with the engineers and researchers at Google who were already protesting Google's involvement in this project. They were concerned about their involvement in the drone program. They were concerned about how this could be applied to autonomous weapon systems in the future. And they were just generally concerned with Google's attempts to become a major military contractor and not just, you know, selling a simple service like a word processor or a search, which they do anyway, but actually developing customized systems to do military operations, analyze these systems and apply their engineering skills and resources to that. So we really joined together as academics to support those workers. The workers passed around an open letter, and then we passed around our letter. So the Google employees letter received over 4,000 signatures, and our letter from academics received almost 1,200, few shy. So we really got a lot of, I think, mobilization and awareness. And then Google agreed to not renew that contract. So they're not dropping it. They're going to continue it till the end of the year, but they've said that they will not renew it in the future.
Well, that's a podcast from the Future of Life Institute there. Just a couple of extracts from it. Peter Asaro from New York City University. Martin, this is a horrendous area of science, isn't it? We've just heard literally the most recent story on this one from a week or so ago. Elon Musk has pledged not to manufacture disgusting killer robots. There are one or two other people who've taken this pledge, but, I mean, surely the military are just going to do it one way or another.
Well, I mean, there's a question of whether you should have a military at all. And if you're going to have a military at all, I suppose they're going to want killer robots. The question of whether Google, as a, you know, people-friendly company, as it tries to present itself as, should be involved in that is another question, isn't it? You know, the military is embedded in everything that we do as a result of the war on terror, the manipulations that are going on behind the scenes and all the rest of it. So the actual mechanisms by which violence is carried out are, in a sense, secondary. I mean, artificial intelligence robots are no more evil in one way than dropping bombs from a conventional aeroplane when you shouldn't be doing it.
What about the comparison there with tort law we heard at the beginning, where he's saying effectively someone that manufactures one of these, anyone that's killed by it, there should be compensation afterwards?
Yeah, well, that's basic you know, law for lawful circumstances. But war is an unlawful circumstance by definition. I mean, in a war, you kill people and you get indemnity to do so. Although, of course, some people then get called terrorists and arrested. Others get pensions at taxpayers' expense.
I see. Also, as a last word tonight, Cy Hirsch, one of your favourite journalists, has come out saying Bin Laden didn't do 9/11.
He didn't say that exactly. He said he doubts whether the story stands up, which is probably as far as somebody in his position can go. But the fact is, as you know, Tony, and we've covered on this show for many years, the story of 9/11 is basically bogus.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show...
Well, I am the leader of Meta 25, so... If we win, I'll be prime minister. Not that I want to. But, you know, it's a dirty job. Somebody has to do it.
So you'd want to be prime minister?
Nope.
You don't want it?
Nope, I don't. But you see, I do believe in reluctant politicians.
Former Greek finance minister and renowned progressive economist Yanis Varoufakis is trying to become prime minister of his country. He'll join us to talk about that, the economic crisis, and the history of democracy.
Let's be Greek for a moment. Aristotle defined democracy as a regime in which the many, the majority, control government. And then he added, which by definition means the poor control government, because the poor are the majority in any country, or the relatively poor. We don't have that kind of regime. The whole point of our liberal democratic regimes is to make sure that the riffraff, the demos, is kept very well away from the levers of power.
Yanis Varoufakis joins us for the hour next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The Trump administration today proposed weakening Obama-era mileage standards designed to make cars more fuel-efficient and less polluting. The administration also said it wants to revoke the long-standing ability of California to set its own stricter standards for tailpipe emissions and mandates for electric vehicles. California Governor Jerry Brown quickly called the Trump administration proposals an assault on the health of Americans everywhere. Brown said under what he called Trump's reckless scheme, motorists will pay more at the pump, get worse gas mileage, and breathe dirtier air. Brown added, California will fight this stupidity in every conceivable way possible. Former Republican California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger called the Trump rule a stupid policy and said if the president thinks he can win this fight, he's out of his mind. California has had the ability to set its own stricter tailpipe limit since 1970 under a federal waiver. 13 other states and the District of Columbia have adopted the California standards. They account for about 40% of the country's new vehicle market. California and 16 other states already filed suit over fuel efficiency standards in May, anticipating the new Trump regulation. Forecasters say the threat of major fires will remain high across much of California and the northwestern corner of the country throughout August and September through October for California. The state's governor, Jerry Brown, and top fire and emergency officials held a briefing on what the state's fire chief calls California's fire siege. Christopher Martinez reports.
California's already bad wildfire season still has a long way to go, and it's a sign of things to come in future years as climate change leads to worsening fire conditions. Governor Jerry Brown sees a big change from the time he was first governor in the 1970s.
The biggest change is the fire season lasts so much longer, and the fires are so much bigger. That's it in a nutshell.
CAL FIRE Director Ken Pimlott described what he calls a fire siege, with 16 major fires burning more than 320,000 acres. He says it's not just a California problem.
The entire western United States, including south into Texas, is experiencing significant fire conditions. And there are over 27,000 firefighters on the fire lines throughout the western United States.
On the state capitol beat, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The Trump administration faces a deadline by the end of the day to explain how it plans to reunite all immigrant parents with their children, including the more than 400 deported parents. San Diego federal judge Dana Sabra has ordered the government to provide identifying information to the American Civil Liberties Union, which successfully took the federal government to court to order reunifications. The ACLU is working with non-governmental groups in Central America who are trying to locate immigrant parents who were deported without their children. Speaking on CNN, ACLU attorney Lee Gelernt said that's a top priority, and they need the Trump administration to hand over all the information it has.
We have some addresses now. We don't know if they're the last addresses, but we have some addresses for some of them. We believe the government has some phone numbers. We're going to have to do whatever we can. I mean, a lot of the families speak indigenous languages. We know what parts of Guatemala and Honduras that language is spoken. It's going to be tough, but we're not giving up hope, and that's why we're asking the government, give us any information you have. The more, the better.
A Houston, Texas immigration attorney says an immigrant child died shortly after being released with a parent from a family detention center outside of San Antonio. Attorney Mana Yagani said the girl died after being released from the detention center as a result of possible negligent care and a respiratory illness she contracted from one of the other children. No further details were immediately available. Zimbabwe police say the death toll from yesterday's election-related violence in the capital rose to 6 after 3 people died from their injuries. Police said at least 14 people were injured. Zimbabweans and international election observers condemned the military for opening fire on opposition supporters who took to the streets to protest what they said was vote rigging by the Election Commission. Zimbabwe's opposition presidential candidate Nelson Chamisa said the country's electoral commission has known the outcome of the election since Monday night, and the pending announcement is just a formality. Chamisa said he won and President Emmerson Mnangagwa lost. Zimbabwe's electoral commission said it will start announcing the results of the presidential election later this evening. I'm Eileen Alfandari. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I'm very happy to welcome back to our radio station Yanis Varoufakis. Yanis Varoufakis is an economist. He is a former finance minister for Greece. He was at the center of Greece's financial crisis a few years ago and resigned after his government accepted a deal from the European Union and European creditors that would require his country to take another loan and also institute further austerity measures. He is founder of the group DiEM25. It is a group that is campaigning for the revival of democracy in Europe. And now he is also the founder of another political party. It is called European Realistic Disobedience Front. We're going to be talking about that. Yanis Varoufakis is also author of a number of books. His latest is called Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. Yanis Varoufakis, it's great to see you again. Thank you for being here.
It's wonderful to be back.
How's Greece doing? It's no longer in the headline news here in the United States. Really, since the time right around your resignation. Mm.
You know, when there is a prison break, an attempt by prisoners to escape or to take over a prison, suddenly the TV vans arrive and it's a big news item.
Yeah.
And it's the talk of the town. But when that rebellion is quashed, then it goes out of the news. It doesn't mean that the conditions in the prison have improved. So I think that's my metaphorical answer to your question. Greece today is worse than it was yesterday, and tomorrow it will be worse than it is today. We are on a steady decline, a shrinkage of the political economy. We are losing 15,000 to 20,000 young men and women, well-educated ones, every month. For a small country, that is, you know, that's a process of bleeding, of brain drain and a physical
brain drain. Yeah, that's what's happening to Greece right now.
Yeah, it's been happening for years, but it is continuing to happen. And of course, you know the saying: it's madness to expect different results if you're doing exactly the same thing over and over again.
You've recently written an article that I was reading about how much of Greeks and assets, public assets, have been sold off.
It is staggering. And it is actually quite obscene. Not just the fact that we had these privatizations. Because, you know, with friends and colleagues from the other side of politics, we can have interesting debates about the merits and demerits of privatization. But this is not privatization. This is a fire sale. Just let me give you an example. We sold off our railways for $50 million. $50 million doesn't buy you anything.
Yeah, no.
Doesn't even buy you the main offices of the railway company. So we sold it off. And it would have been okay if we sold it off to a foreign company that came to Greece and invested seriously in our railways. We didn't even do this. We sold it to an Italian company that they don't have 2 cents to rub together. They can't afford. So they just bought it in the same way that speculators buy, failed companies to asset strip them.
That's what happened with the rail system?
Yeah, that's just one example. I can give you lots of examples. Let me give you another example from 2012, 2013. We sold off the National Lottery. The national lottery of any country is, okay, it's a tax on stupidity because you're effectively asking people to give good money in order to gamble when you know that in the end, on average, you're going to lose. But nevertheless,
provides income
aside the moral issue about having a national lottery, it is a cash cow for the government. It's not a question of efficiency. It just is, you know, the goose that lays constantly golden eggs for the state. And just to give you an example, that company had was contributing about $300 million every year in profits to the state, and we sold it to a Czech company for $600 million. That's a one-off payment.
$600 million.
See, you receive $600 million,
yeah,
and you lose an income stream of $300 million every year forever.
I mean, at least in the state of California, sometimes when you win the lottery, you'll win as much as $600 million.
But you see, the point I'm making is that even if we were neoliberals, we would look upon this as a crime, a criminal act this kind of sale. It's not a fair price. And, okay, now let me add the icing on the cake. And the Greek state didn't get a single penny of this. Not even that, because it all goes to the creditors of Greece. Greece is bankrupt. And we keep borrowing more money from the creditors along the lines of extending and pretending. So they're giving us, it's like, you know, not being able to repay your mortgage because your income has subsided. And the bank is pushing upon you a credit card from which you draw money every month to pretend that you're repaying your mortgage. Of course, the credit card will run out. And then you're given a second credit card and a third credit card. And of course, the debt, the unsustainable debt, piles up. Now, add to this the fact that these new credit cards, bailouts as they're called, are given to Greece on condition of immense austerity, which shrinks the income. So imagine. I mean, not even the Satan would contemplate ever this kind of deal, where the Greek state is being given one credit card after the other, on condition of shrinking the national income from which they will have to be repaid. How old do you need to be to realize that this cannot end well?
We are in conversation with Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister for Greece. He has now formed, which we are going to talk about, a new political party, European Realistic Disobedience Front. Important to have the disobedience in there? In the name?
It's central.
It's the first political party I've heard with disobedience in it.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Because, you know, Greece is the first case of a Great Depression that lasted a decade. So the only responsible thing to do in a situation like this, in a situation where you have 10 years of non-stop depression, is to, on the one hand, put forward moderate, realistic, and internationalist, broad-minded proposals on how to solve the problem. And at the same time, that's the constructive part, and at the same time, say no to anything that perpetuates this misanthropy. So constructive disobedience, responsible disobedience, is necessary, and it is our party's main platform.
Will you be running for office?
Yes, I will.
Which office?
Well, I am the leader of Mera 25, so if we win, I'll be prime minister. Not that I want to. But, you know, it's a dirty job. Somebody has to do it.
So you'd want to be prime minister?
Nope.
You don't want it?
Nope, I don't. But you see, I do believe in reluctant politicians. I spent all my life in academia, in universities. And I always used to think that anybody who wants to be dean of a school should be banned from being dean of the school. Because my thinking was, what is the point of wanting to be a professor?
Yeah.
To teach, to read, to write, to participate in debates. Why would you want to be a manager? If you wanted to be a manager, why don't you go to Google or Amazon and make a lot of money as well? Yeah. So any professor who wants to be dean, I used to think to myself, should be immediately disqualified. It means that they are not good at what they do. So, but somebody has to do it. And why would you ever accept to do it? Not because you want to do it, but because it's public service. You know, you say, oh, look, folks, I will do it for 2 years, but no more. And somebody take it away from me in 2 years' time. So as long as you do it reluctantly and in the course of delivering public service, that's good. If you want it, you shouldn't do it. I believe the same thing applies to being president, prime minister, yeah, senator, congressperson, or member of parliament. Those who want these positions should be disqualified from having
them. One who wants power probably shouldn't have it.
Indeed.
For good reason.
Oh, absolutely. Because
yeah, those who don't want power.
We should all understand that you know, that power is is a corrupting influence on people. And we should try to keep away from it, but use it for public purposes.
And you say it's a pain.
Yes, it is. It is a pain. It is. I wish that we didn't have to do politics. I wish that politics was... you were telling me before that you were in Greece recently, yes, at the Agora. I wish that we were all at some Agora, sitting there, sipping coffee or wine, and discussing matters of philosophy and politics. But actually, you know, the party political endeavor is a very painful one.
Well, speaking of talking about and debating politics and even philosophy and ancient politics, the idea behind DiEM25 and then now your political party is what you call reviving democracy. What does that mean?
It means we don't live in democracies. We live in regimes that are only nominally democratic. In places...
Representative democracy?
Well, it depends on... democracy is supposed to be... Let's be Greek for a moment. Aristotle defined democracy as a regime in which the many, the majority, control government. And then he added, which by definition means the poor control government, because the poor are the majority in any country, or the relatively poor. We don't have that kind of regime. The whole point of our liberal democratic regimes is to make sure that the riffraff, the demos, is kept very well away from the levers of power, to be given the sensation, the feel that they are controlling government, or they're being consulted, but without controlling government. If you read your Federalist Papers, the whole point of the American Constitution was to keep the people out of government and to ensure that through the mechanism of representative democracy that they are not in control.
In ancient Athenian or Greek democracy, or in people who practiced it, would look at the United States and not see a democracy?
Absolutely not. But you see, there's a sense in this, because come to think of it, the foundation of our liberal democratic representative systems is not ancient Athens. It's the Magna Carta. Yeah, that's where it all began. And the Magna Carta was what? It was a charter for barons, not for the people. It safeguarded the right of the barons, of the aristocracy, not to be usurped or taxed too heavily or expropriated by the king. And one of the rights that the barons retained through the Magna Carta process was the right to have slaves, to have the majority as their slaves. Now, if you think about it, it's not very different to the experiences we have. And things are getting worse. Because once the realm of power was one, and it was all intertwined, politics, economics, was all one thing. But with capitalism having split up the political sphere from the economic sphere, and having put most power into the economic sphere, democratization of the political sphere happened at the time when the political sphere was being demeaned. Women understand this very well. Feminists understand this very well. It's like, you know, the feminization of professions. So when women moved into teaching, teaching lost its power. Teaching lost its prestige. Similarly, democracy moved into the political sphere as the political sphere was losing its power. And then something even worse happened. The economic sphere subdivided between the industrial sphere and the financial sphere. And all power went to, you know, to Goldman Sachs, to the financial sphere. And now we have a situation where you can have somebody like Barack Obama. He's elected in 2008, assumes office in 2009. And according to his own words, I report this in the book, he told me personally, he said, I felt that, you know, I had absolutely no option when I got elected. I had to bail out the people in Wall Street, and whether I liked it or not. When I was elected, I went to my first meeting of European finance ministers, and I was told in no uncertain terms by the German finance minister that elections cannot be allowed to change economic policy. I'm not the one, the maverick, who comes out and says, oh, we don't live in a democracy. They do. Right? Barack Obama, Wolfgang Schäuble. It is clear that we live in a world where the ruling class loathes democracy, but loves to use the term democracy in order to cover up for the absence of democracy. Now, if this world worked well, then maybe we would need democracy.
So be it.
Right. So be it.
Yeah.
But we do need democracy, because the world doesn't work well, especially during crisis. Democracy is the only way of having a sensible manner by which to distribute losses and burdens. Systems that are not democratic may do reasonably well during the upswing, during the good times. But when the crisis hits, without democracy, you have illegitimacy, and you have a combination of authoritarianism and incompetence by the ruling class, which, in the end, undermines even their own interests.
You mentioned Aristotle, and that's where we get a lot of our information about ancient democracy, through his Politics. And as you mentioned, the way he saw democracy was that the poor ruled over everyone else, including the rich, because they were the majority.
They controlled government.
Yeah.
Yes.
he wasn't supportive of that.
No.
He didn't think that was necessarily a good idea.
Oh, yeah, he was an anti-democrat.
Yeah.
Not as rabidly anti-democratic as Plato.
As Plato. Or
who was who actually wrote a book on celebrating dictatorship.
Republic?
The Republic, yes. And, you know, he actually... Plato foamed at the mouth at the sound of the word democracy. Aristotle was also
an aristocrat. It was democracy that put his teacher to death, Socrates.
Yes, that's right. That's his excuse. But if you read the Republic, it's more than that. He actually has a deep philosophical pessimism about the capacity of humanity to generate collective action that is in the interest of humanity. So he believes in a top-down, very strict dictatorship, and he hopes the dictator will be enlightened.
A philosopher king.
A philosopher king,
yeah. He had a word for what he concerned about democracy. What is it, ochlocracy?
Ochlocracy, yes. Ochlos means the mob. Mob
yeah,
rule.
It would become mob rule.
Even to this day, is it not the case that those who want to demean democracy, they refer to it as mob rule, or whenever somebody gets elected that they don't like, or the democratic process yields a kind of tax for corporations that corporations don't like. All of a sudden, it's mob rule. It's not democracy anymore.
You're right. The concern is also, though, if you devolve into mob rule, then you set the conditions for the return of a strong-armed tyrant mm-hmm. that people accept because the tyrant is going to restore law and order.
Now, that is always the case, especially during periods of deflation, like in the 1930s. When Mussolini was celebrated for making the trains run on time and creating order and making sure that the garbage gets collected. And we see this today. We see this combination of, on the one hand, a populist concern, a pseudo-concern about the working man, but mixed in with misogyny, racism, hostility towards organized labor, rejection of the concept of collective decision-making and democratic process, this is all coming back. And it's no great surprise because capitalism is now experiencing its second 1929 moment. And, of course, our generation's 1929 was in 2008. The fundamental difference between 2008 and 1929 is twofold. On the one hand, central banks printed a hell of a lot of money in 2008, which they didn't do in 1929, but of course bestowed it upon their friends in the financial sector. So they refloated finance, but they did not refloat investment. So there is this semblance of recovery, but no real recovery. And the second factor that made 2008 our generation's 1929 different to the original 1929 is China. Because the Chinese Communist Party, the government in China, played a massive balancing or rebalancing role. United States capitalism owes a great debt of gratitude to the Chinese because they cranked up the private credit bubble to such an extent that they effectively picked up some of the slack that the United States and European economies created.
FDR saved capitalism in the 30s. China saved it.
The Chinese Communist Party now.
Now, yeah. Yep. Irony.
Irony is delicious,
yeah,
isn't it? But the fact is that the Chinese authorities can no longer continue to do this on behalf of the West. They could only buy time for the West, and they could only do this while the West was getting its act together. But the West has not gotten its act together. The European Union is ungovernable. There's no European Union government. I mean, in the end, all that happens is that the European Union is effectively undermining its own sustainability through an inability to end austerity and to do a new deal in Europe. And the United States is the United States. You don't need me to tell you what it is. It's either completely ungovernable because you have a Congress vetoing the president vetoing the Congress, or you have Donald Trump.
Yanis Varoufakis is an economist and former finance minister of Greece, and he is now a candidate for prime minister of his country. And we are in conversation about the nature of democracy and the crisis of democracy today. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I do need just this one moment to ask you for a financial contribution to keep Letters and Politics on the air. And if you're listening to KPFA in the San Francisco Bay Area or on KFCF in the Central Valley. Today is the final day that this radio program will be asking you for such a contribution. If you are listening to KPFK in Los Angeles, well, your drive is still at the beginning stages, so we will be talking again. My approach in this fund drive has been to bring a show that you tune in for, an exchange of a contribution that is reasonable for you, one that you can afford. Don't want you to bust the bank, and one that you'll feel good about as you go upon your day. During this summer fund drive, we have talked to Stephen Greenblatt about Shakespeare's politics because, well, I certainly think that we are certainly living in Shakespearean times today. We had a fun conversation with Arthur Eckstein about the fall of the Roman Republic and its parallels to our own time. We spoke to Kyle Harper about how climate change in the ancient world, and really because of some really dramatic volcanic eruptions, set the stage for a mini ice age in the 5th century and helped lead and help set the conditions for the fall of the Roman Empire. And then Deborah Plant on Zora Neale Hurston as an anthropologist and Zora Neale Hurston's work with Kosala, who in 1927 was the last surviving man stolen out of Africa, came over on the Middle Passage, was enslaved in the United States, was then freed, and had to try to figure out a new life in a new world. And then yesterday it was the daughters of Alan Watts, Joan and Ann Watts, and today, well, it's Yanis Varoufakis. It's about the best that I can do. And my attempt in this drive is to bring a program that I hope is educational, thought-provoking, and interesting, in the hopes that as I pass around the hat, you will throw in what you can. And that's what we're doing again today. We do need to average about $100 per pledge to meet our financial goal. But that's, as always, somebody pledging $25 or a number of people pledging $25 and then somebody else pledging $400 or $500 or even $1,000. There are thank you gifts. We have Yanis Varoufakis' books. We have the Letters on Politics Tyranny Pack. You could talk to the phone operator about all that. What I'm asking for is a pure donation, because in the end, that's what this relationship is about. And it's the best way that you can help your radio station, because then we can take that full contribution and put it back into the radio station and all the things that this radio station does, both on and off air. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org, if that's the station you're listening to, or kpfk.org. Now, just quickly, a special word for the listeners of KPFA here in the Bay Area. As I said, today is the last day that this show is seeking your support. Now, our goal for KPFA over the summer drive, and KPFA is important because it's only through KPFA that we have this radio program. It's what gives it all its financial support that it receives. And so our hourly goal to really justify our time around here is about $3,000 per fundraising day. Up to now, we've been averaging $2,300, so clearly way below where we need to be. Now, it's doubtful that we are going to be able to make that up today, because it would basically mean that for KPFA alone, we'd have to raise $7,000. But all I can do is try. If you are one of those individuals that can afford a larger contribution, you could help me right now if you could pledge $500 or $1,000, potentially even more in this hour. We could turn that into a matching fund, and you can help me spur other listeners to match that if we are able to do it in a particular period of time. It's up to you. I'm asking what you can do. Again, $25 is also extremely valuable to me. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. We now return to our conversation with Yanis Varoufakis. Yanis Varoufakis, if you become Prime Minister of Greece, what do you do for revival of democracy? Did you push
for direct democracy? How do you envision this?
Well, in Greece, we don't have a luxury to even begin to imagine this question at this stage, because we are in a Great Depression. So we need a new deal. We need to do something that Roosevelt did. But of course, we are a vassal state of the European Union. So in Greece, if you were asked me, what would you do Monday morning? I say Monday morning because all elections take place on a Sunday in Greece. The answer is legislate six or seven things that are absolutely essential. Necessary conditions, not sufficient conditions for recovery, but necessary conditions for recovery. Having to do with, a haircut of private loans, ending the repossession of homes and auctioning off of homes, a debt restructure of the public debt, reducing tax rates. Here's the left winger who wants to reduce tax rates, because when you've got zero profits amongst the business community and a failed economy, you can't really have the huge tax rates that we have.
Right?
A stimulus, yeah. So we need that. And if this means that we will be thrown out of the euro, let us be thrown out of the euro. We're not proposing that we exit the euro, but if Europe says, if you do what is necessary for your recovery, we'll throw you out, well, throw us out.
So you're not saying we want to leave the euro?
No, I don't.
Currency, but if that's what happens to implement your plan.
If you want to throw us out because we want our country to recover, throw us out. Do your worst. I said this to them when I was the Minister of Finance.
That's what you've been saying all along.
And that's why I was not particularly liked by them. But the question about democracy is, of course, and you are quite right, what needs to come immediately after that, on the second week or the third week. And you asked me about direct democracy. Look, I believe that we need a mixture. Not so much of direct and indirect. We live in complex society. So representative democracy is necessary. We cannot have the ancient Athenian system where all the citizens gathered on a hill and made decisions. Because remember, anyway, they were not all the Athenians. The women were not there. The slaves were not there. And the metics or the migrants were not there. So we do need a representative system. And here is, I think, something that the ancient Athenian example can teach us. You mentioned before Aristotle and Plato being aristocratic and anti-democratic.
And aristocratic meant of the best, right?
Look, the ruling class always thinks of itself as the best.
Yes.
Because this is their justification for the fact that they have power. They are the best, so they are the aristocracy, so they should rule the roost. But there was a very interesting clash of ideas between the democrats and the anti-democrats in ancient Athens. The anti-democrats, the aristocratic party, if you want to think of them that way, liked elections. The democrats disliked elections, which today sounds paradoxical, but it isn't, because the democrats argued that when you have elections, the ones who have a greater propensity to win the elections are the ones that have greater resources, which is the aristocracy, the ones who have better rhetorical skills, not necessarily the ones who have better ideas, but they have better rhetorical skills and media today by which to promote those ideas than those who don't have enough resources. So the Democrats favored jury selection, sortition, a random draw.
By lot. Yeah.
And indeed, all positions in ancient Athens at some point were selected by lot, except two. One was the general, who had to have some skills and was elected on the basis of his capacity to lead troops in battle. And the second one was the treasurer. And usually the treasurer was a slave. and you know why? Because only slaves could be whipped if they embezzled money. Citizens could not be. So maybe we should introduce this for Wall Street. Maybe, the only condition for being allowed to be a banker is that you are a slave. I'm joking. Just ignore that. Delete what I just said. We should joke occasionally. So I'm saying this because at DiEM25, we combine within our movement elections for office holders with sortition. So, for instance, we have what we call the validating council within the DiEM25 and our Greek offshoot, Meta25, which makes decisions or invalidates decisions taken by the coordinating committee or committees. And that validating council is selected randomly from all our membership. And they change it every 3 months. And it works brilliantly. We've been doing this for 2 years now. And those who actually get selected by lot to be on the validating council, they actually adore it. They know it's only for 3 months. They have a heightened sense of responsibility because they know that they were not elected. So they've been picked by an algorithm. So none of them acquire this air of self-importance. So this combination of jury selection with elections as well, and with deliberative processes where you select, let's say we have an issue in southern Greece about some environmental concern. We select, our proposal is that we should be able to select by lot 1,000 people who spend, go on a retreat for a week. They present all of the arguments by both sides of the argument, and then they choose by voting amongst themselves what should happen regarding this particular issue. So this is an alternative to the representative democracy as we know it, which combines tradition, lot, and elections and voting.
That's really interesting. And when we say by lot, in a way, a comparative for us to understand here in the United States would be like how we do jury duty.
Yes,
we randomly get selected and
indeed.
You have to, and that's how they had it in ancient Greece as well, except their juries would be like 500 people and they'd vote on it. They'd have like a 90-minute trial and then they'd vote on it and that's it.
That's right.
But that's interesting to me because I just want to harp on this, really nail this point is, and they saw this in ancient Greece too, at least my understanding. I'm not a historian or I'm just a radio broadcaster, so I may get all this wrong. But that said, as you were saying, elections were seen, and I think we still see it today, to favor wealthy people, the people who had means to run for office. So they had it by lot. People were randomly picked to serve in what in the ancient days was called the ecclesia, basically
That's right.
A modern-day assembly.
Assembly.
That's where our assembly comes from. And now not everyone was able to serve in that. Women were not. Slaves were not. About 60% of the population were not. But of those who were eligible to do it, that's how you also kept power from amassing in just a few people's hands.
That's right. And what was quite remarkable in that system was even though a lot were excluded, and that is unacceptable, it was the first and probably the last system of government, at least for centuries, where you had poor people with a lot of political power.
Yeah.
Simply because they were selected, independently of their income, to serve as judge, as the controller of a certain area, and also to have a vote, one person, one vote, within the assembly.
And it lasted about 200 years.
Less. 70.
Yeah. It was, come and go, right?
Democracy is a very fragile flower.
Well, that was my point.
It's very difficult to make it grow, and it's so easy to trample upon it.
So the story of democracy, and I could get this wrong as well, but as far as I understand it, is then you go for a long period of time, almost 2,000 years, without democracy.
Indeed.
And then you get...
And then it gets revived as a form of enlightened oligarchy.
Yeah. And that's what we get with the Enlightenment, this Enlightenment from Voltaire, Montesquieu.
Well, they never lived to see anything resembling democracy. There was a period during the early days of the French Revolution when you had a democratic process, but it ended up in the bloodbath of the
military
Great Terror.
Dictatorship. Yeah, well, the terror and
Napoleon after that.
I mean, that's Aristotle's cycle right there. Right?
And then the concept of democracy was revived through the extension of the tradition of the Magna Carta. The first members of parliament were effectively appointed by the lords. They had a constituency of three people appointed by the lords that elected the members of parliament. And then the franchise started expanding and expanding and expanding. And it became almost universal suffrage by the time that all the important decisions were not being taken by parliament or by within the political sphere, but they had already been shifted to the boardrooms of the great corporations.
Right. That's where we are now.
Yes.
Greater participation, yet less power.
So, let's face it, there are two great challenges that we face. The first one is to stabilize the system that we have, because the capitalism we live in, this oligarchic capitalism we live in, is not even very good at looking after itself. Since the 2008 crisis, we have all the evidence in the world that oligarchy capitalism, globalized, financialized capitalism, is in constant crisis as a result of its own architectural fallacies. So we need to stabilize this, because where I disagree with many of my left-wing friends is they seem to believe, like the left believed catastrophically in the 1920s, that if you have a great crisis like 1929, capitalism collapses, and then immediately the good society, socialism, is going to emerge. No, it won't. Not necessarily. Hitler may rise up, which is what happened in the 1930s, and what is happening today. The only political beneficiaries of this never-ending crisis of capitalism are not the progressives of the world. They are not the left. They are not internationalists. They are the militant parochials like Donald Trump, like Marine Le Pen, like the neo-Nazi party that controls half of the government in Austria, the Orbans in Hungary, and so on and so forth. So we need to stabilize. We need to find ways of boosting investment into green technologies, green energy, and so on, to create good quality jobs. We need something like a New Deal to stabilize what we already have before we can start having.
Does that mean saving capitalism again?
Well, saving civilization from the rise of the political monsters that breed in the ruins of capitalism.
Yanis Varoufakis is our guest this hour, and we are in conversation about both the nature and the crisis of democracy. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I need just this quick moment to give you a fundraising update. So far this hour, we have raised $1,000, and again, I am asking you to pledge what you can. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. If that's the radio station you're listening to, you can also pledge online at kpfk.org in Los Angeles in Southern California, if that's the radio station that you are listening to. We do have thank you gifts. You could talk to our phone room operator about it. They, the books of Yanis Varoufakis are available. The tyranny pack that we did specifically for this fund drive, that is also available. But of course, what I am really doing is asking you for a donation that you can afford, one that's reasonable for you, one that you'll feel good about, one that is according to your own means. And it's really interesting. I'm looking at all the names who have pledged so far, and a lot of people so far have called in and also gone online. And a vast majority of them, maybe 90% of these, are all either $20 or $25 pledges. And these are folks that are they're doing their part, And I do want to thank Darlene and Berkeley, George in Hillsburg, Nancy in Pinole, Diane in Running Springs, Catherine in San Rafael. So many of these names I know and I recognize. Holly in San Francisco, Sheila in Berkeley, Mark in Richmond, Luis in San Francisco. Mary V even called in a donation even before I asked for one, from Boulder Creek. And I know this isn't the first time I've said her name in this fund drive. So Mary V, thank you so much. And it's interesting, you see this sort of people power coming through right now, and you see so many donations for $20 and $25. And I'm just thinking at this point, we're going to have to do it on our own, my friends. It's not usually how it works. So that's okay. The phone number, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. We now return to our conversation.
If FDR saved capitalism with the New Deal, is this similar? I mean, do you see?
Well, the difference, my difference with FDR, is that FDR wanted to save capitalism.
Yeah,
he was a patrician, like Keynes, the great John Maynard Keynes. He loved capitalism. His problem with capitalism was that it wasn't very good at looking after itself, and he needed the state in order to come in and save it from itself. So the difference that I have as a left winger, as a progressive, with both Keynes and Roosevelt, is that I do not believe that capitalism can be saved, but it can be stabilized. And it is important to stabilize it in order to create the circumstances so that you and I can have a conversation with many other people out there, free from the terror of not having any prospects in life, of being in an Uberized labor market, of, you know, even if you work for Google or for whatever, burning up and burning out by the age you are 37 and then being cast aside like, you know, a piece of dirt. People who are in the clasps of such fear cannot have this discussion that we're having today. Right. They can't be in the agora, in the virtual agora, that will plan post-capitalism. And post-capitalism is inevitable because capitalism is undermining itself. Robotization, artificial intelligence means that capitalism is going to become unsustainable. The question is what comes after that. So my view is we need a new deal in order to stabilize capitalism, not to save capitalism, so that we can then transcend it.
Unsustainable because, I mean, obviously you're using up all resources and all these things, but also because of technology, there just aren't going to be jobs the way we had that.
Well, there will be jobs. There will always be jobs.
But
if you go to Bangladesh today, there's no person who's unemployed. Not a single person in Bangladesh is unemployed. They all have jobs, even if they're beggars. You know, begging is a job. It really takes a lot of hard work. You're not sitting there being leisurely. But they're not jobs that can sustain you. They're not jobs that can give you any prospects in life. So there will always be, Uberization has a long way to go, both in terms of width and in terms of depth. It will absorb a lot more people, especially young people, and it will become even more atrocious in terms of the living conditions of those who are Uberized. This is the point. The point is that capitalism is creating these magnificent productive powers that can generate all these remarkable gadgets, technologies, goods. Soon we're going to have jetpacks or aeroplanes that we can park in our garage. You know? But it does not generate the capacity to consume them. So you have this major incongruity, imbalance between productive ability and ability to consume, which then translates, and we already have this, into another incongruity, a major imbalance between savings and investment. We, since 2008, globally speaking, we have the highest saving rate in the history of humanity. We have more savings today than we ever had. And the lowest level of investments in the history of humanity relative to the level of savings. So this imbalance between savings and investment and productive capacity and capacity to absorb on the other is getting worse, and it will only get worse as the wonderful technologies that are invented in this part of the world, Silicon Valley and so on, multiply and proliferate. And therefore, at some point, the combination of the 3D printer and internet-based design will mean that soon there will be no need to have a General Motors, no need to have a corporation, because, you know, the design will go straight into a huge printer, and the thing will be printed out. And it will be like a public utility, the printer, more or less. So what's the point of having a General Motors? Yeah. So that kind of technological foundation does not allow capitalism as we know it to survive. So the question is, what follows? It could be a dystopia, or it could be a very nice utopia. And what will follow will depend on politics.
Yeah,
it depends on what we do. We have to act, and we better act democratically.
Well, what could we do that you think works?
Well, let me give you an example of a policy that DiEM25 is proposing. You've heard, I have no doubt you've discussed many, many times, universal basic income. Mm-hmm. We have a different view. We are against universal basic income to the extent that universal basic income means that you tax people in order to provide a basic income to everyone. And that is very divisive, I think, especially amongst the blue-collar workers, people who work all day, and suddenly somebody tells them that there will be somebody sitting on their couch watching television who will be paid from their tax and say, what? Am I stupid or what? Unconditionally as well. So we are against that. But why not have a common wealth fund which is endowed with an increasing proportion of the shares of the corporations? And the reason why I'm proposing this is very simple. Once upon a time, it was possible to argue that the private capital, the capital of a company, was its own. So, you know, Henry Ford, went out and purchased a certain production line from some supplier who had actually created it with his hands or the hands of his workers. And that was private capital that Henry Ford appropriated or purchased and then put it to work, produced the Model T, made profits. He could say that his profits were his just reward for the fact that he took that piece of capital equipment and put it in there and combined it with human labor and so on and so forth. But today, every time you search on your Google engine for something, you add to the capital stock of Google. So capital is increasingly produced by all of us. And still the profits of capital are appropriated by the shareholders. Now, that doesn't seem right. And it doesn't make either economic or political sense. So one solution would be to say to Google, okay, you want to continue operating like this, 20% of your shares go into a public wealth fund. And that accumulates dividends, which then get dispersed to all members of society since your capital is produced socially. Everybody searches on the Google engine. So initially it would be a trickle. The universal basic dividend, as we call it, would be a trickle. But in the long run, as automation and artificial intelligence triumphs over human labor, those shares of corporations that go into the public equity fund or wealth fund could increase, and eventually you can have a recycling system where society effectively benefits financial, all of us equally, you know, universal basic dividend, from the work of the machines, of artificial intelligence, and then we have, all of us, the consuming power to purchase the products of the robots and of the corporations. So that's one way of imagining a democratized economic sphere, which does not necessarily mean that the state owns things, but society has a share of property rights over capital goods, which it is helping bring together.
Yanis Varoufakis, we are out of time, but thank you. Evaristo Parakolou.
I think we are out of time as humanity, but we better find some time to make changes that are absolutely necessary to make our world sustainable. Parakolou.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And your endeavors. We'll be following what happens when those elections come. The best to you.
It was a pleasure.
Again, Yanis Varoufakis has been our guest. His latest book, Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. We are now down to our final 6 minutes for our listeners on KPFA in the San Francisco Bay Area, as well as KFCF in the Central Valley, located in Fresno, our radio station there, in our summer 2018 fund drive, in which this radio program, Letters in Politics, will be asking you for a contribution that you can afford, that's reasonable for you, that you can feel good about as you go upon your day. So far this hour, we've raised $2,000. We now have 5.5 minutes to go. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Pledge online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org, depending on what station you're listening to. For our listeners in Southern California, today's day number 2 of a short summer fund drive. And we need to have these fund drives because this is how we pay the bills. This is how we run the radio station, the way that we are able to say no to commercials, no to corporate underwriting, no to just a few large donors that would then hold sway over what we can do on these radio stations. The way we're able to do it is we come directly to the listener. It's a tradition of public broadcasting, truly an American tradition. And one of the few, you know, an American tradition I can actually feel good about. So the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online at kpfa.org. I think I said we're at $2,000. The only way we're going to make our averagely goal this drive is we got to $7,000. Not looking like it now, but I still am heartened by all the donations that I do see coming in. Many people that are pledging $20 and $25. We're not getting the big ones this drive, and that's been my shortcoming for some way. And of course, it may be, $25 may be very big to you, and I certainly do recognize and honor
honor that. The way we make this work, here we are in the San Francisco Bay Area, the wealthiest place on the planet. And we do know that there are some folks who have deeper means than others. And if we had everyone donate what they can according to their own means, we could make this work. We can have these type of conversations during Fund Drive and still be able to make it by. But it's not working for that part, that latter part, the bigger donations. Lots of folks have donated, and that's why I've kept with it even though we're behind, because it was important to me to honor the people who did pledge. $25 is a lot, and I'm extremely thankful for that. So the phone number, if you still want to get in and support us, is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. I'm not sure what it is. It probably is some of my the way I'm framing it. Maybe I'm not appealing to people very well in that way, or maybe folks are just concerned about, you know, the whole issue over tariffs and a potential trade war. I don't know. It's something I'm going to certainly have to examine. But I do ask you for a donation of what you can do, because it's what allows us to do this work. I see this hour here, 10 a.m. Monday through Thursday, kind of as our stage. And the stage is this ancient spot in civilization where people from the beginning of time have used to explore their world, explore their time, explore their history, to explore the human predicament. You can go to the ancient Greek plays, for example, Sophocles or Aeschylus, and you'll see that they're grappling with the questions of their own time. The fall, even, of democracy in ancient Greece is quite fascinating when you do that. And that's how I like to see this hour. And we do it, obviously, this isn't a play, but it's through the act of conversation. And we can do it because of you. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online at kpfa.org and kpfk.org. We are now down to our final 90 seconds. Lee in Emeryville, there's another name I recognize. Certainly want to appeal even to the folks who don't pledge very often to this radio station, because we do see these names again and again and again, and we wouldn't be here without them. No doubt about that. They are solely responsible for us being able to do this show, but it's also unfair to require the same people to do it again and again and again. We want to put the community back into community radio, and that's by that's everyone doing what they can. But Lee, muchísimas gracias. Jerry in Austin, hopefully listening to kpfa.org. Jerry, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Deb in Knightson. I want you to know, Deb, I know where Knightson is because I grew up in the neighboring town of Oakley. So always good to see people from the land, right? But when I was growing up, we didn't even have street lights at the time. Not that this was the 50s or 40s. I was growing up there in the 80s, but it was a small town. Richard in San Luis Obispo, thank you so much for that. Keith in San Jose's just got a call in. Keith, very kind of you. Who else we got here? I want to make sure. I don't want to. Kevin and Claremont. Thank you, Kevin. Anne Cherie and Point Reyes Station. James and Vallejo. Michael in San Diego. Darlene in Berkeley. Another name I know very well. Many of these names I know. Did I say George in Hillsburg? I might have said that before, but I'd hate to have missed him. Here's the phone number the last time for this program. 1-800-439-5732 and pledge online at kpfa.org or kpfk.org. Thank you.
Renegade economists. How to resist the demands of permanent economic growth and protect the earth, indigenous communities, local agriculture, and women. Kate Raworth. How modern economics has failed the poor and wrecked the earth while making a few people very rich. Renegade economist Kate Raworth spoke on October 4, 2017, at the Stockholm Resilience Center on her new book, Donut Economics, published in the UK and US in April 2017. The book has already been translated into Italian, German, Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, and Japanese. Kate Raver says that economics dominates public policy and our decision-making for the future. It guides multi-billion-dollar investments and shapes our responses to climate change, inequality, and other environmental and social challenges that define our times. However, economic theories as taught today are centuries out of date. That's why it's time, Raver says, to revise our economic thinking for the 21st century. In her book, Donut Economics, she sets out seven key ways to fundamentally reframe our understanding of what economics is and does. She points out how we can break our addiction to growth, redesign money, finance, and business to be in service to people and create economies that are regenerative and distributive by design. Donut Economics offers a radically new compass for guiding global development, government policy, and corporate strategy. And it sets new standards for what economic success looks like. Kate Raworth's guiding principle is to, quote, meet the needs of all within the means of the planet. From Kate Raworth's 35-minute Stockholm talk, I chose her fascinating retelling of the history of economics, from Adam Smith to Paul Samuelson, and her indictment of neoliberalism, market fundamentalism, and the universally imposed system of economic growth that's expressed in the GDP, the gross domestic product. Here is Kate Raworth.
I'm going to give you a whirlwind tour, and there could be no better guide than this man. This is Paul Samuelson. He was professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the 1940s. And his textbooks are the mother of all economics textbooks still taught today. Now, Samuelson knew the power that he had in writing the textbook. He said, I don't care who writes a nation's laws or crafts its advanced treaties, so long as I can write its economics textbooks. The best bit. You see, Paul Samuelson thinks your mind is a blank slate and he's going to lick it. And he has already licked it, because he's licked all of our minds. You see, when Samuelson sat down in the 1940s to draw a picture of the economy, he was teaching engineering students, so he made it easy for them. He drew it looking like a radiator system. You have businesses and public, what we would call households, and you can see that water's being pumped in there and it flows around and around these pipes. Now, what he's showing is income flows around the economy just like water would flow around pipes. It's a clever metaphor if you're looking at the circular flow. Trouble is, this diagram has changed only a little bit in the last 70 years, and every economic student learns it as the circular flow of income. So we've got the essential market relationship between households and business. Households provide their labor and their capital. In return, they get wages and a share of profit. And they use that money for consumer spending to buy goods and services. And so the resources go round and round, and so does the money. And yes, not all money is used for consumer spending. Some of it is taken by banks and turned into investment. That's not actually true. That's not how banks work. But I'm not even going to go there today. Some of it is taken as taxes, and then government can spend it. That's not even how government spending works. I'm not even going to touch that today. And some of it goes off for imports but comes back for exports. Trouble with this diagram, of course, is that it only shows what's monetized. That's the only flows it tracks. It makes absolutely no mention of the living world, of all the materials and matter and energy drawn daily into the economy and spewed out as waste and pollution. It makes no mention of the unpaid caring work of parents, or the cooking, washing, cleaning, sweeping that many of us have already done today and do every day to make that labor and the future labor fresh and ready for work each day. And it makes no mention of the commons, the place where people come together and organize, not with the market and not with the state, but as a community, to create things they value without money changing hands. Well, if the picture that we have of the economy today at the start of the 21st century says nothing of the living world, says nothing of the unpaid caring work of parents, says nothing of the commons, then we're missing some of the most fundamental sources of our well-being, and those blank spaces will come back to bite us. What about who we are? That story goes back to Adam Smith. And Smith actually had a nuanced view of humanity. He said that self-interest is powerful for making markets work, but it's our interest in others that is essential for making society work. And he championed and celebrated our sense of public spirit, justice, generosity. He said these are the traits most useful to others. But that was too nuanced when the economists wanted to create a model of humanity to put at the heart of economics. And so when people like John Stuart Mill came along, Mill just plucked out one trait. He said political economy does not treat of the whole of man's nature, but sees him as a being who desires to possess wealth. And right there, he defined us as this creature who we now know as rational economic man. He'd look like this. He'd be a man standing alone, money in his hand, ego in his heart, a calculator in his head, nature at his feet. He hates work and he loves luxury and he knows the price of everything. And the trouble with this character is not how absurdly narrow he is. The real trouble with him is what looking at him does to us, is doing to you. Because, and this was the most fascinating thing I learned, the more that economic students learn about this character, rational economic man, as they go through their studies, the more they come to value self-interest and the less value they give to collaboration, altruism. So what began as a model of man, we start to mirror him. It becomes a model for man. So who we tell ourselves we are shapes who we become, which means there's an extraordinary responsibility on any academic discipline that claims to tell us who we are, because it changes who we become. But if we are going to be more than 10 billion human beings on this planet this century, and we continue to imagine and conduct and justify ourselves as rational economic man, we stand very little chance of thriving here together. What about how the economy works? Well, this story goes back to the 1870s, when a small group of economists were desperate to make economics a science as reputable as physics. And so they looked to the great physics of the day, that of Isaac Newton. This is his diagram of gravity pulling a ball to rest. And so when William Stanley Jevons began drawing his economics diagrams, he drew them in the style of Newton. It looks like physics. It smells like physics. It must be physics. And he said, just as gravity pulls an object to rest, so markets and prices pull markets into equilibrium. He talked of the market mechanism and market forces. You can hear the Newtonian physics in the language. This diagram is part of the first diagram that every economics student learns today, supply and demand. The analogy is still there at the heart of what we get taught. But the real problem with this metaphor, this desire to be like physics, is actually that it set economists off searching, just as Newton had found the physical laws of motion, they began to search for the economic laws of motion. And when data became available, then they started number crunching and looking for the hidden patterns so they could find the laws and have them named after them. And two of these apparent laws have been extraordinarily influential in our politics for decades, and they look very similar to each other. Now, the first one is called the Kuznets curve, discovered by Simon Kuznets in the 1950s. He said, I think I see a pattern, UK, Germany, and the US over time, as the economy gets richer overall, inequality first increases, but then it decreases. He even said, I wouldn't expect this to happen. I'd expect the rich to get richer, not the poor to catch up. But he tried to explain and understand what he'd seen. He said it might even be a figment of this particular period in history. It would be terrible if it became an unwarranted dogmatic generalization. He said that. That's exactly what happened, because this image becomes a mantra and it whispers silently to us, if you care about inequality, no need for redistribution, you socialist. Just make sure the economy grows, because growth will eventually even things up. And then the second one in the 1990s, the environmental Kuznets curve. A little bit of data on local air and water pollution. It seems to show the same, that as economies get richer, first pollution gets worse, but then it gets better. Like a well-trained child, the economy will clean up after itself. If you care about the environment, don't try and regulate. No. Growth will grow now and clean up later. Look, There's a law of motion. Of course, both of these turn out to be false. They don't exist. But the mantra and the image are so powerful that it justifies trickle-down economics, austerity economics, and grow-now, clean-up-later policies. And they have shaped the policy landscape for decades. So the fake physics turned out to be fake, but it was a jolly good excuse in between for pursuing growth. And here Simon Kuznets comes in again. He was brilliant. He knew the caveats of everything he created. They just got ignored. In the 1930s, US Congress asked him to come up with a single measure of the US economy. And he did. It's what we now call GDP. And when he created it, he said, this could scarcely be used to measure the welfare of a nation. It ignores the unpaid caring work of parents. It ignores the value of the community. And it's just a flow. So what's happening to the stocks underneath? But his caveats got pushed aside because the temptation of that single number to measure a country's progress year on year, and then when you could compare the US to the USSR and Europe, then you've got a horse race. And so we've been living for decades with economies that have come to expect, depend, and demand endless growth. In 1960, W. Rostow wrote a book. I love it so much, I got myself a first edition. It's called The Stages of Economic Growth, a Non-Communist Manifesto. And he said there are five stages of growth. First, you have the traditional society where nothing really is happening. Then you have the preconditions for takeoff when you get the beginnings of a banking industry and mechanization and education for work. And the people must be touched with the belief that growth is good for something beyond itself, like a better life for the children. Then you get takeoff, where growth becomes the normal condition, and the march of compound interest begins to bear its blessings. Then you get the drive to maturity, when you can have any industry you want, no matter what your resource base. And finally, lastly, the era of high mass consumption, where you can buy all the consumer goods you want. Well, you can hear the implicit metaphor, the aeroplane. But this aeroplane ride is unlike any other because it can never be allowed to land. Rostow left us flying into the sunset of mass consumerism. And he knew it, as he said in his own book. And then the question beyond, where history offers us only fragments. What to do when the increase in real income itself loses its charm? But he never answered the question. And the reason is because it was 1960, he was going to be an advisor to the presidential candidate John F. Kennedy. And Kennedy was running for election on the promise of a 5% growth rate. So Rostow's job was to keep that plane flying, not to ask if and how it could ever be allowed to land. So I've shown you the caveats. And when you hear the caveats and the blank spaces and the uncertainties around these diagrams, they look flimsy. But it's on those very uncertainties and blank spaces that powerful stories can be built. And that's what happened in the 1940s. A little band of economists met in a little Swiss village called Mont Pelerin. This is Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman. They said, we're going to write a new story of the economy and we're going to call it neoliberalism. They began because they saw the rise of the totalitarian state in the USSR. They wanted to push back against state power, but it quickly morphed into a push for market fundamentalism, the idea that everything could best and first be sorted by markets. And their ideas never got put into practice immediately. This was the 1940s, but they seeded think tanks, university posts. They worked with the chambers of commerce. They built up the narrative so that when Reagan and Thatcher came to power in the 1980s, they were ready. And Reagan and Thatcher were surrounded by members of the Mont Pelerin Society. And we've been living by that narrative ever since. So it's the neoliberal story of economics that stars the market because it's efficient, so give it free rein. It stars finance, which is infallible, so trust in its ways. It stars trade, which is win-win, so open your borders. And every great story has a villain. So it stars the state, which is incompetent, so don't let it meddle. Other actors not needed on stage, but we can meet them anyway. Well, it stars the household, but that's domestic. You can leave that to the women. The commons, you all know the commons are tragic. We better sell them off. Society, as Thatcher said, there's no such thing as society, so we can ignore that. Earth is inexhaustible. Take all you want. And as for power, well, we don't need to talk about power in economics. This is a positive, rational, objective science. So don't mention it. I believe this is the story that has been taking us to the brink of collapse. No wonder we live in a world in which so many people's most essential needs are unmet, and yet we've already overshot the bounds of our planet. How do we turn this around? We need new economic thinking for our times. So, of course, you can guess, I think it comes with new pictures. I'm going to give you a whirlwind tour of what I think is the new story we need to tell. So first, let's start where my economics degree never even went. We never asked the question, what is the economy for? What is its purpose? I think the purpose of the economy is obvious. It is to meet the needs of all within the means of the planet. In my silly speak, to get into the donut. To live between social and planetary boundaries. So what mindset would give us the best chance of getting there? If I could show the first diagram to print on a new economic student's mind, I would never show them supply and demand. That says the economy is the market and the market's in equilibrium. That's two lies in one sentence. I wouldn't even show them Samuelson's radiator. I would show them this picture. I call it the embedded economy, and anyone who knows any economics will see it's drawing together ecological and feminist and commons theory. So you have the economy, which is embedded in society and all its social and cultural institutions, embedded within Earth, and it's drawing in living matter and materials and spewing out waste. And immediately we can ask the first question of ecological economics, which is how big can that through flow of materials and energy be before we begin to kick the Earth out of kilter? And it's bathed in a river of solar energy, so how can we be ingenious to capture that to meet our needs? But also the economy itself is divided into four forms of provisioning. Not just the market and the state, that was the 20th century ideological boxing match. You know, are you for free market, laissez-faire capitalism, or are you a state-loving socialist? And that argument squashed out space for seeing the other two sectors, the household, where we all begin every day with unpaid caring work for our children, our partners, our parents, our neighbours, but also the commons, where we collaborate to make things happen without money, but with community getting together. And of course, it was Ellen Ostrom's work that put this back on the economist's map. And then there's finance, which should be in service to this provisioning, in service to life. What would it look like to have a financial sector that actually served this provisioning and served life? What about who we are? We're not rational economic man. We're so much more interesting than that. Yes, we can be competitive and self-interested, but we're also socially reciprocating and collaborative. Like these acrobats, we can do things together that we could never do alone. We have to move from the me to the we. We're embedded in the earth, this woman sowing seeds, our connection with the earth. But also, we're not independent and isolated. We're deeply interdependent. We're not dominant over nature, but embedded within the web of life. And we're not work-hating. We're purpose-seeking. And those are the lucky ones for whom those come together. We need this new, richer picture if we're going to thrive together. What about how it works? Forget that Newtonian physics and gravity. And if you never got the joke about why did the chicken cross the road, the real punchline is that he wanted to teach you systems thinking. So the elements of systems thinking, I say, is the two loops. You've got the reinforcing feedback loop, and the essence is the more you have, the more you get. So the more chickens you have, the more eggs you get, and the more eggs you have, the more chickens you get. Anything in the world that spirals up or spirals down is dominated by reinforcing feedback. And then you have the balancing feedback loop. The more chickens you have, the more road crossings they attempt, and the more road crossings, the fewer come back. Most of the interesting patterns in the world, from your family dynamics and your family relationships to the boom and bust of stock markets to the rise of the 1% to the collapse of ecosystems, are best understood through thinking in systems, which is why after the financial crisis of 2008, economists turned to the long-neglected economist Hyman Minsky. Nobody had even heard of him. He'd been left behind in the 1970s. He had a theory called the financial instability hypothesis, which brilliantly explained what had happened. When you read Minsky's work, it's all about reinforcing and balancing feedbacks. He used systems thinking to explain what's going on in the world today. So if systems thinking is useful, it means it's time for a metaphorical career change for economists. Don't be a Charlie Chaplin trying to pull on the levers of the economy because it's not a machine and they ain't there. Be more like Josephine Baker here, watering her garden. And I like to think of an economy as a complex, evolving system, ever adapting. And as an economist, therefore, your role is to tend and steward and intervene at the places where you can shape it towards the design we want. We design gardens. We don't control the plants, but we design gardens. So the question is, don't look for the laws of motion. Search for the principles of design. And what are those principles of design? I believe there are two that will guide us best. To be distributive by design and regenerative by design. And I'll say briefly what I mean by both. So an economy that's distributive by design is one in which value generated is shared far more equitably with everyone who helped to create it. The 20th century focused redistribution, if it ever dared to do it, on redistributing incomes from rich to poor. But I think we have to go deeper and look at the sources of the ownership of wealth and pre-distribute the sources of wealth generation. Of course, it's already happening. You can redistribute the ownership of housing. Here's some housing in Germany that was designed and built by its own inhabitants. Redistribute the energy systems thanks to renewable energy technologies. Here's an employee-owned company where the value created by the company goes to the employees, not some distant shareholders who never even turned up at the premises. And the distributive ideas of ideas. This is a makerspace where people create things using open source design and they contribute their own ideas into the open source economy using Creative Commons licensing. This exists already. The distributive economy is emerging already. How can economists help it emerge faster? And then regenerative design. We take Earth's materials, make them into stuff we want, use it for a while and throw it away. And that's what cuts against the cycles of the living world and pushes us over planetary boundaries. So we have to bend the arrows around and create a circular or cradle-to-cradle economy. Let nature regenerate herself. She's been doing that for 3.8 billion years. We must get out of the way. But even the materials that we create, from this table and the laptop to the glass, to regenerate, restore those. Again, it's happening already. Here's Sanergy, a company set up by some MIT graduates in the slums of Kenya where there were no toilets. They created toilets, they collect the human waste and turn it into organic fertilizer. It goes back on the field, closing that nitrogen and phosphorus loop. Open source vehicle. If you buy one, it comes in a kind of IKEA flat pack box. It comes like this. If you know what you're doing, you can assemble it in 1 hour. It's modular by design, 100% electric, and then you can build and customize it. And there's a global R&D team of people worldwide using this, so you become part of a global network of manufacture and design. And Houdini, I bet lots of you have some Houdini clothing. 60% of their clothing is already in the circular economy. They only use recycled polyesters and nylons, and they use wool and tencel. All of these, by the way, are distributive too by design. Economists have an incredibly exciting opportunity. How do we create the business structures, the financing, to enable this stuff to come through? So back to this question of growth, because you see, Rostow left us flying into the sunset of consumerism. We live in economies, as he described, that have been structured to depend upon unending growth. They're financially, politically, and socially addicted. Financially, because at the heart of today's financial system is the design of money and finance, which always pursues the highest possible rate of return. Politically addicted, well, no G20 leader wants to lose their place in the G20 family photo, but if your country stops growing, you'll get budged out. So we have a massive collective action problem here. Socially addicted, because thanks to a century of consumerist propaganda, we've been told that the best form of therapy is retail therapy. To transform yourself, buy something more. None of these addictions are insurmountable, but we need to overcome them. We need to get off the airplane ride. We need to flip away from thinking of unending growth. Nothing in nature does that. We need to mimic nature and allow economies that grow and then mature, that allow us to thrive whether or not they're growing. And think of this, put the design principles at the heart. Economies have the market, the state, the household and the commons. Only the market and the state show up in GDP. So it's only a partial snapshot of all the goods and services and value created and exchanged. We need them to be distributive by design, far more equitable, nationally and globally. We need them to be regenerative by design if we're not going to crash over planetary boundaries. So we need to get off that airplane ride. And I like to replace one metaphor with another. So instead of thinking airplane that can never land, we all need to learn kite surfing. Now, kite surfers have a bar in the middle, which you pull up and down to balance between the winds and the waves. And you're pulling it up and down, and that bar is moving in response to what's needed to work with the wind and the waves, with the regenerative and distributive. To me, that's a really great metaphor for what GDP needs to be allowed to become, a response variable that might go up and might go down in response to a far greater calling, an economy that's regenerative and distributive by design. One little example, China is investing $360 billion by 2020 in solar energy capacity installation. So that's a great big uplift for GDP. But once it's in, the economic value that'll go through GDP of generating electricity falls to near zero marginal cost. So it's not contributing to GDP. So you get this uplift and then nothing as a result of becoming regenerative and distributive by design. How can we transform? our current system so that GDP stops being this essential target and becomes a responsive variable. To me, that is one of the most profound, challenging, and exciting questions for the 21st century economist. So I leave you with a new story, a story of the 21st century economy, which of course stars Earth, because she is life-giving, so we must respect her boundaries. It stars society, people, because it's foundational, so we must nurture our connections. It stars the household, which is core. We begin there every day, so how do we value its contribution? The market is incredibly powerful, so how do we embed it wisely? The commons are extraordinarily creative. How can we unleash their potential, especially with the rise of the digital commons? And the state, of course, is essential. So how do we make it accountable? As for finance, it should be in service. What would it mean to have a finance sector that actually serves society? Business is fantastically innovative. How do we give it far more purpose than just maximizing profits? Trade is double-edged. So how do we make it fair? And power, it's everywhere. It's pervasive. We have to talk about it and check its abuse. I believe this is the beginnings of a new narrative of 21st century economics. And of course, it's time to take economics out of the ivory tower, out of the equations, bring it back out of our heads, into our bodies, our hearts, our bellies, make us laugh. We have to reanimate economics for the 21st century. I will stop there, and I really look forward to discussion, critiques, suggestions. How do we make this actually happen? Thank you very much.
That was Kate Raworth. She's teaching at Oxford University's Environmental Change Institute and at the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. Over the last two decades, she has worked as senior researcher at Oxfam and as a co-author of the United Nations Human Development Report. Her book, Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist, was published in April 2017. And you just heard a rebroadcast from October 2017. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this program, we discuss cultivating beauty in the space between brilliance and madness with Ken Paul Rosenthal, an independent filmmaker based in San Francisco, California. Rosenthal says his work explores the geography of madness through the regenerative power of nature, urban landscapes, home movies, and archival footage from hygiene films. And in his 2011 film, Crooked Beauty, reveals his artistry and cinematography skills. Rosenthal's 2018 film, Whisper Rapture, is a musical and mental health documentary focusing on Bonfire Madigan and her cello. The music you are hearing now is by Bonfire Madigan and her cello, played with permission. Being no stranger to demons of the mind, Rosenthal readily shares his personal experiences with those demons and describes how communities of like-minded people can collectively ease the pain and find joyful creativity in the spaces between brilliance and madness. When Ken Paul Rosenthal and I visited by phone from his home in San Francisco, California, on July 30th, 2018, we began our conversation when I asked him to describe what many people call mental illness.
use the term normal, or what is also known as psychonormative in mainstream psychiatry. And I think we really need to first acknowledge that people's notions of normalcy are far broader and diverse than our culture gives them credit for or the ability to experience. So if you're not living a very linear, easily defined life, if you're living outside the margins of what culture considers the way one should live, then you're off the track. There's something wrong with you, and possibly you might get pathologized as ill, as mentally ill. And I think we need to think about emotional health rather than mental illness, and that there's a spectrum that we all live on, and that we're always changing. Our inner lives are immutable, like plants, but we're not always mindful of the fact that we can change all the time and experience that spectrum as a normal part of our experience. Instead, we'd sort of self-pathologize, but compartmentalizing ourselves into the mainstream. It's far easier to wade in the mainstream and dive into the heart of our own darkness.
So where do you personally, Ken Paul Rosenthal, fit in to this spectrum from your perspective?
My lived experience is having been born into the world as an artist with a very rich and fertile imagination. And although it's a blessing on the one hand, it's actually something of a dangerous gift. And what I mean about that is for virtually my entire life, I've seen played out on the stage of my mind a very rich tapestry of self-harm ideation, and I often manifest that in actual self-harm. And the way I've come to manage that is through my meditation practice. And what I've learned is, like a lot of us who have a lot of voices, a lot of endless chatter in my mind, I've come to recognize those images, those voices, that ideation as a way to return me to direct experience. That is, in meditation, they say, well, when you have that chatter, the way to vanquish it is by returning to the breath. And the way I dealt with all that internal chatter and all that violent ideation and acting out was through the direct experience of self-harm. Now I come to recognize that as a way of vanquishing those thoughts. There was a kind of release that happened in the wake of hurting myself, as many people do who indulge in those practices without going into the details. But via my meditation practice, I see now that a more enlivening and sustainable practice is to simply return to breath.
Well, Ken, tell us about how the radical mental health movement fits in.
So my discovery of the radical mental health movement has helped me reframe what I saw as problematic inside to reframe it as something I can ally myself with rather than demonize it. And by changing the language and also by understanding that the struggle, like in creative expression, when you have obstacles to overcome, they bring you to places that you could otherwise not have arrived at had you not embraced them more fully.
So tell us more about the radical mental health movement.
The radical mental health movement, specifically the Icarus Project, whom I discovered in 2005, it's an international community of people who see extreme emotional experiences not as a biological knot that's tied around our neck, that we're damaged from the neck up, but instead it's a dangerous gift. Again, it's something that that with the right mentorship, community, tools, skillfulness, will help us navigate the space between brilliance and madness rather than going to the extremes of mania or depression.
How is that done?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of tools. It's not over the counter, like a silver bullet. It's our culture says that how that's done, how we take care of our emotional health is with a pill, but a lot of wellness is in community. Like my yoga teacher said many years ago, that we change our patterns on the mat and then they move inwards. So that was a really profound metaphor, because it's just like we reposition our relationships and our actions out in the world. In other words, healing is shared. It's something we do interdependently, not solely within ourselves. I think a lot of wellness is about getting out of ourselves. It's getting over ourselves by allying ourselves with other people who are also struggling.
Ken, you speak of wellness being in community. In your movies, Crooked Beauty and Whisper Rapture, how do you reveal that?
Well, I think cinema, first of all, is intrinsically a collectively experienced endeavor. And when people are sitting in the dark, I think it's sort of like prayer. Everyone's focus is cast towards the screen. When I'm sitting in a theater, I can feel what people are feeling around me. Depending on the film, you know, we're going through a range of emotions in unison. And that's really rare these days. People are generally lost in the virtual light of their social networking devices. You see it all the time in public transportation, walking around the streets, people driving their cars. They're already so isolated in that respect, and they're becoming even more fragmented. When you're in the theater, it's a collective experience. And I take a tremendous amount of responsibility in creating a space that is compassionate. If I'm going to have people there collectively experience potentially triggering issues, then the job for me is to show up in a way where people can transpose their experience into something that is transformative and transcendent.
When you say show up in a way, how do you put that in the movies that you make?
Right. When you listen to the news, it's generally about all the chaos and terror that's in the world. And I feel there's a lot more beauty and poetry in the world than terror, but that's not reported. And I did a lot of research on other mental health films before I completed my first one in 2010. And so many of them were portraits of suffering, or they graphically revealed the inner tortures of the featured character. But I wanted the featured characters in my film to be empowered, to be portraits of courage, and not to romanticize their mental distress, but just to create a space where people could integrate the stories that they were observing up on the screen into their own lived experience, and to do that in a way that was more lyrical and poetic rather than graphic and violent. I often use images that are from the natural world, because in the natural world, it's mutable, it's organic. It's, if there's a fire, then there's rebirth. If a vine or a plant hits an obstacle, it knows to twist and move around it so that it could reach the light. And it's really important for me to create that kind of nourishing context in which to hear these portraits, to observe these portraits of mental distress.
Ken, I hear that as explaining your goal, and I would like you to describe what would be seen in your films Whisper Rapture or Crooked Beauty.
Yeah. Well, usually when you see a documentary, you're looking into the eyes of the speaking subject. Oh, it's about a person that's being profiled. Of course, you want to look at the person speaking, but I rarely show the person speaking. It's almost like radio, because when you hear just a voice, you integrate it more into your imagination. If you see the person speaking, you may feel, well, of course, it's a first-person narrative. Of course, you want to see them talking on screen. But then there's a potential othering that goes on. There's the damaged person. There's the diseased person. There's the person with the problem. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but as a filmmaker with roots in the experimental side of filmmaking, I was really interested in the construction of the person up there and on the screen, and how we see affects what we see and what we feel. I'm very compelled to embody the speaking subject's testimony in the outer world. And that way, when people leave the theater, they don't look at a tree the same way. Let's say instead of seeing a tree as just branches and leaves, and they think tree, They may see it as a metaphor for the synapses of the mind. You know, there's a lot of healing that happens in nature. It's kind of a cliche. You know, we escape to nature, but we know the feeling of walking around downtown versus walking around in nature. There's a release. There's a letting go. Actually, speaking of Whisper Rapture, the project I just finished, it kick-started during a one-month residency I did on Hornby Island, which is a very small island with only 800 residents, which is about 9 hours northwest of Vancouver in Canada. And over the course of the month that I spent there harvesting images for the film, I didn't have one shred of anger or any sort of emotional volatility within me. And I realized that that was because I was embedded in nature, and I didn't have anything aggressive or constructed around me to sort of contain what otherwise would be an organic flow of my experience.
Our guest is San Francisco filmmaker Ken Paul Rosenthal, who lives in San Francisco, California. His films show nature, designs, and structures, sometimes in fast motion, to visually enhance the telling of the stories and the theme of the film. And his current film, Whisper Rapture, tells the story as flowing through a cello, played by the primary character in the movie. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Ken, would you please tell us about your two films, Crooked Beauty and Whisper Rapture?
Sure. One day I walked into my apartment in 2005, and there was a magazine laying on a coffee table. It didn't even belong to one of my housemates. It belonged to a house guest. And the title of that magazine was Navigating the Space Between Brilliance and Madness. It was the first publication of an organization called the Icarus Project, which is a community support organization by and for people with extreme emotional experiences that get commonly labeled as mental illnesses. I opened up this magazine, I read the first article, and I was literally inseminated with the idea to make Crooked Beauty. The way the author, Jax McNamara, spoke about their experience of extreme emotional distress was couched in a language that spoke deeply to my own experience of the world, which was one predicated more on how do we handle our deep sensitivities rather than pathologize and label them as illnesses. There was also something very cinematic and visual about her language that really spoke to me as well as a filmmaker. So I contacted them, and 2 days later we met, and I pitched the film right then and there. Now, she co-founded the Icarus Project, and the featured character in my latest film, Whisper Rapture, Bonfire Madigan Shive, was the third founding collective member of the Icarus Project. So I came to know Madigan and her music and her pioneering mental health activism through the Icarus Project. She actually contributed a little bit of music to the first film, Crooked Beauty, and then getting to know her as a friend and ally over the years through the radical mental health movement, I decided it was time to make a film about her life and her music.
Ken Paul Rosenthal, in my viewing of Crooked Beauty and Whisper Rapture, I was very much drawn to the visuals. The visuals were of nature, of structures. They moved quickly. And I'd like you to talk about your intention and goal in causing them to be seen that way.
The core of my mission as an artist advocate is to help alleviate human suffering by cultivating beauty. And I'm really interested by embodying internal states of mental and emotional distress by using images from the extant natural world and light as conveyed through time-lapse photography in urban space as well. There's something very integrated and healing, as we all know, with the animate world. And as madness is very much a reflection of a social condition, I'm really interested in how we have sort of anesthetized ourselves in the natural world and buried ourselves in the virtual light of our social networking devices, which really fragments our inner states and I think kind of perpetuates a lot of distress that we're already feeling. So I'm trying to create a compassionate space with my films so that when we see the speaking subject up on the screen, there's not an othering that's going on. The problems and the struggles that the featured characters in my films have are not just about the person up there. They are more easily integrated into the experience of the audience because they're articulated and embodied in a larger landscape than just the skull, if you will. Our cultural narrative is that we're diseased and damaged inside if we have what is commonly labeled a mental illness. There's a biochemical knot, as it were, around our neck. But we need to think about madness as a reflection of a social condition. So I'm always thinking of a broader environment for how we can experience mental health issues. And I'm very, very committed to doing that on as compassionate a stage as possible. And that's why I use images that are as beautiful and lyrical and poetic as possible.
That was my focus, the choice of your images. And what I was asking was you would go from one image, sped up photography, to another image that to me seemed to fit the dialogue that the speakers were reciting at the time.
Yeah, and I never, as I'm sure you observed, I'm never illustrating exactly what they're saying. What I'm trying to do is embody through tone and texture. You know, my background is as an experimental filmmaker, and I don't like to identify as that anymore, but aesthetically, the films are still very poetic and lyrical. So, for example, in Crooked Beauty, which is a black and white film primarily, I was really interested in how can I privilege and harness the extremes of mania and depression visually. So I was thinking about opposites, the union of opposites, black and white, light and shadow, rough and smooth, fluid and concrete. I toured with that film for almost 4 years internationally, and people always were astounded at how acutely the images embodied and they would even say, you know, illustrated exactly what she was saying. But it's not like she was ever talking about the tree or the grass. It was just that I made very, very mindful choices about how is the visual nature of this image, how is it aesthetically reflecting the essence of what the person is saying. So the experience of listening to the speaking subject's stories in my films becomes a felt experience rather than one that's just understood.
Ken Paul Rosenthal, how do you select these images?
That's my favorite question in the world when discussing my films, because I never consciously choose them. They choose me. We all know the term a shot or shooting a film. And I always felt those terms were so violent. And there's an intentionality to there. And conventionally in a film, you have something that's scripted. Something is written. You go and you shoot. You grab. You record. I go for mindful walks. I flaneur, I consciously wander, and I wait to be called to what I like to say is harvesting the image. To me, when I am harvesting these images, it's really like gleaning ripe fruit from the world. It's kind of like I am making the unknown known. And I know all this sounds very esoteric in a sense, but on the other hand, they're made manifest very, very clearly in the films. I actually even bow to the subject, for example, a tree, after I'm done harvesting the image, because I feel it was given to me rather than something I, quote, shot.
When you find them, I assume it is because you were called to them. What I would like to ask you, Ken Paul Rosenthal, is how do you know or feel that you are being called to harvest an image?
Well, I like to call it a practice of deep listening with one's eyes. But it's not just the eyes. So, for example, I will see a trembling branch. The wind is blowing the branch. Now, superficially, you'd say the wind is blowing the branch. But to me, it's a gesture. It's the tree sticking out its index finger and saying, come over here, check me out, I have something to tell you. I think indigenous peoples had a much more intimate relationship to what the writer David Abrams calls the sentient soil. The narratives are inscribed into the very landscape that they walked on and that we walk on. For example, when you're out in the woods and you see deer hoof prints as markers for the narrative of that path that the deer trod, there's a story there. Now, what does it say if we're walking on a path that's covered in concrete? There's nothing to respond to. You're literally, your experience, your connection to the earth is literally being cut off. So how can we wake up? You know, I just read a review of Spike Lee's new film, and he was saying the whole core of his film work is to wake up. So what kind of world do we want to wake up into, and how can we wake up into it if our experience is literally paved over?
Ken Paul Rosenthal, what is your answer to that question?
Well, I can respond with a quote by Jay Krishnamurti, who said, it's no measure of wellness to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society. So I think it's important to be curious, because the root of curious is cure, and to find the places in our culture that are authentic and that are more about lived experiences rather than those that are just a reflection of the chaotic times we live in.
So again, how do we find them?
Well, I think we have to learn how to write our own stories, because when telling your own story, you can't let anyone else pick up the pen. And I think, again, we live in a virtual state of distraction. People turn from their shadows. And I think we have to find some sort of practice. The reason why it may sound like I'm hesitant to say what that practice is, because I think each of us are incumbent to find what that practice is that allows us to sit with our shadows rather than demonize them or medicate them away, because there's information there. I'd like to quote Bonfire Madoc and Shive, the subject of Whisper Rapture. We medicate and suppress and pathologize what we don't understand because we're terrified of the mystery, instead of really allowing that which terrifies us to be a part of the experience. I always sense that there's something extremely sacred in what we call sickness, and that there is a shadow of ourselves in that mystery that we are being called to show up for.
Well, Ken Paul Rosenthal, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And I'd like you to share with us a eureka or an aha moment that shaped your life.
The single biggest aha moment of my life was not only when I picked up that first publication by the Icarus Project, but when I read specifically in the opening essay, which was called Anatomy of Flight, it said, birds with asymmetrical wings cannot fly. And that did not initially make sense to me, because I thought, well, a bird's wings must be symmetrical so it can fly. But it's just like looking at the flaps of an airplane's wings when you're looking out the window and you see that they're moving. And what they're doing is shifting to maintain flight depending on the currents, the air currents that are coming its way. And a bird does the same thing. So the idea, simply put, is that it's in our asymmetries, or in the way we manage our sensitivities, in their imbalances, that we can learn to navigate that space between brilliance and madness and not fly too high like Icarus, the myth of Icarus, which is what the Icarus Project took its name from, and crash and burn because we become intoxicated with our powers, but simply find a way to manage, to become more skillful managing our sensitivities, our so-called asymmetries, and navigate that space between brilliance and madness.
And can you share with us what you would like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I'm really interested now in creating a mental health pop-up that I'm calling YES, which stands for Your Empathy Stand. The model for this is Lucy's therapy stand from the Peanuts cartoon. What I'd like to do is have a mobile mental health pop-up that I can take around town on my bicycle and set up in any park. I want to give people 10 minutes to speak to me about whatever's on their mind. I would largely listen, but at the same time, I would offer them a prescription of wellness practices, be it spiritual or physical or nature-based, and then send them on their way.
And finally, Ken Paul Rosenthal, is there a film or a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
David Abrams' book, Spell of the Sensuous. It sort of reframes the way we speak about the world, and a follow-up book to that called On Being Animal and Earthly Cosmology. And in terms of a movie, Leave No Trace.
Well, Ken Paul Rosenthal, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Ken Paul Rosenthal is an independent filmmaker based in San Francisco, California. The books Ken Paul Rosenthal recommends are both by David Abram, The Spell of the Sensuous and Becoming Animal, An Earthly Cosmology. The film he recommends is Leave No Trace, about a father and daughter who lived off the grid in the wilderness. This program was recorded on July 30th, 2018. There are over 700 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, radiocurious.org. They're all free to listen, download, share as my gift to you. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.